We're recording.
All right.
So today is March 14th, Pi Day. I am Isaac Lee. I'm from the Oral History Program. I'm here with Carla Ratz. We're at 21 North Park Street in the admin suite. Carla, if I could just ask you to start off by spelling your first and last names, and then we'll get started.
Okay. It's Carla Ratz, and it's CarlaRatz. And the first part of my history, I was Carla Frye, F-R-Y-E.
Oh. Maybe that's why, when I was doing a little bit of background research, I couldn't do some
Couldn't
records
find
didn't
me.
Pop up. Ah, could explain it. All right, well, then that leads perfectly into, we'll get started, and this is kind of standard for most oral histories. It'd be great if you could just tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, maybe some early work experiences and early experiences in your education.
Okay. I grew up on a small farm between Mount Horb and Verona, so we were not too far from Madison. I attended a one-room school for 6 years, and then we moved into a three-room school. So I had the same teacher for all 6 years when I was in the one-room school. I was very active in 4-H. Every summer we would have numerous 4-H projects, and one of the money makers was to show cattle, because we had Holsteins on our farm. And if you got a top prize, you would make a significant amount of money. And so that was kind of our income when I was, in grade school and then early high school. In high school, I participated in a lot of activities. I was fairly popular. I was the homecoming queen, and I was the drum majorette. And at the same time I was in high school, I was, attempting to make money because wanted to go to college. And so I drove the tractor for baling hay, and I got like 5 cents a bale or something like that, and helped clean the barn, took care of the cattle in the barn, and fed the calves. When I was 16, I worked at the A&W, and later on when I went to Stevens Point, I would I typed some papers for a professor there. When I was at home, I paid rent, and then went off to Stevens Point. So, do you want me to move on into when I went to Stevens Point? Or?
Can I ask?
Sure.
Did you, when you were in high school, when you were starting to raise money for college, did you have an idea of what you wanted to study when you went to university?
I wanted to be a math teacher.
Wanted to be a math teacher.
Yes, I did. My parents were not wealthy at all, and so they didn't have much money to help send me. At that time, we didn't know much about scholarships,
right.
And now when I look at it, I think I should have applied for scholarships. I was like in the top 10 of my graduating class, but we only had 93 in my class. So my first day at college, my dad took me up to Stevens Point and dropped me off.
Were there any teachers? How many teachers were in your high school, or how big of a
high school was it? There was probably a total of maybe 400 students in the
right.
whole high school. It was Mount Horb. And how many teachers? I had some very influential teachers. I definitely was into typing, and I learned shorthand, and I tried to learn French. But other than that, it was the standard, basic classroom. Nowadays I don't even think they teach you shorthand anymore, or even typing. They must with the computers, but I participated or competed in a number of typing contests, and I was able to type like 100 words a minute.
Wow. Did you win any of them?
I don't remember exactly if I won. I know I was toward the top end.
Wow. Did you, you said there were a couple of very influential teachers early on.
Probably the ones that were in more what we called commerce at that point in
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
I also had a appendicitis when I was a junior in high school, and it turned out it was a ruptured appendix, and
Ouch.
So I was out of school for a while, and but I caught up again. It was, I think, in my junior year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think of going somewhere else other than Stevens Point?
I think I was influenced by friends
mm-hmm.
who were going to Stevens Point, and I back then you just didn't really investigate other schools. You just kind of followed along with what your friends were going to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
So then, after Stevens Point, or I guess maybe if you wanted to talk a little bit more about your time at Stevens Point and what.
Well, there were a couple things at Stevens Point. One was that I was running out of money, so that's one of the reasons I only went there a year. And I also had a German teacher who was teaching math, and I had such a difficult time understanding her, and she was. I don't recall what the class was, but it was like I had no clue what was going on. And so that kind of burnt me as far as whether I should go on into being a math teacher. So I think that was one of the deciding factors, too, as to why I didn't try to continue.
I see. Do you remember any other classes at Stevens Point that you did?
Not really.
They
were fine. It was just that math class that... It was kind of upsetting at the time.
Yeah, that's. I'm sure you would have been a great math teacher.
I'm not sure. I did much better with what I ended up doing.
I agree. So then, what made you decide to move to Madison?
It was, again, primarily we lived in close vicinity to Madison, and there wasn't really a choice. You either would go work somewhere in Mount Horeb or Verona, or you come to Madison. And so I really kind of lucked into it and just came to Madison, went to at that time, the personnel office. And the recruitment process was so much more relaxed than it is today. You know, I just walked in and said I'm interested in looking for a position, and they sent me out to a couple of departments and said, here, go interview with these, and that's what I did. I interviewed at Nutritional, or I think it was Poultry Science at that time, and they offered me the job right away, and I accepted it, and then I thought, well, I better go check out physics. So then I went to nuclear physics and interviewed there, and I decided I liked physics much more than I would have liked it in poultry science, so I decided to take the position, and so I had to call poultry science and tell them I changed my mind. So then I took the position in nuclear physics, and so I started there in June 5th of 65. So I got out of Stevens Point probably in May sometime, and I immediately started working.
Do you remember what the interviews were like? As you said, they were much more casual. Perhaps.
It was if I recall, I was only interviewed by one faculty member. It was Ray Herb, who was a very interesting character, and he immediately offered me the position. And there's kind of somewhat of a history with him because me and my husband have stayed in touch with him because he also started a company. And then my husband worked for that company in Middleton and still works there. And Ray Herb passed away. But there were other faculty members in that unit, well, in nuclear physics, that I also would see. And I still see Willie Haberly was one, and I run into him periodically. Heinz Barshow passed away, but he was also a real mentor because I was young and naive. I had no clue what I was supposed to do, they were very, very helpful. There were a lot of grad students there and postdocs, and it was a very pleasant place to work. It was, I was very happy that I took that position.
So do you, so maybe thinking about that position a little bit more, when you first started, as you said you were young, but what was your day-to-day like when you first started?
Well, in a small department, and I think this is still true today, in a small department you do almost everything. I was responsible for some federal grants, and because we had NSF money coming in, and so I had to monitor those grants. And interesting with the grant money, I didn't know how to do a budget and how to monitor a grant. And so Heinz Barshow, or Professor Barshow, I should call him, went with me down to the accounting or business services, and we sat down with someone there, and they explained to us how to read the control budget control sheets, and so then I was able to monitor the budget. And we also had to submit annual grant proposals and progress reports. I was responsible for the payroll of all the employees in that unit, and it wasn't a large unit, but that was all done manually. So I would initiate the payrolls of about 45 faculty and staff. I prepared all the requisitions for the supplies and expense and equipment. I did technical typing of thesis for some of the grad students, and with those papers back then, you know, the typewriters that we used were not even Selectrix. They were, and these were very technical papers. So when I would type a paper, it was replacing a key. If you had a Greek symbol or something, you know, and so you have to reach in there and twist that key out, put the next key in. I mean it, and then you couldn't make a mistake because they had to be perfect for when they went to the graduate school. So if you messed up a page, you had to redo the page. So it was a very different world than today, where you can do everything on a computer and just print it off. But at any rate, I would have grad students just standing over my shoulder telling me what they wanted. And I had one part-time employee and some student help. I checked the radiation because we had the, there was a, what's that called? A big accelerator down in the basement, and so there was radiation, and so everyone had to wear a radiation detector, and I would go around and collect those and send them in and make sure that no one was getting high dosage. Had also had to check supplies, and because we had tanks of liquid nitrogen and whatever, and I had to make sure those were all available. Other than that, it was, it was a good place. People were very friendly, and it was an excellent experience for me to work in a department before I moved on into a division.
Out of curiosity, where would you send the readings of radioactivity?
There was a company you had to put them in a box or an envelope and send them in, and then they would read them, and you'd get the results back. Yeah.
Interesting. And this is maybe backtracking a little bit, but I'm curious, since you had so many different kinds of tasks that you were charged with, did you receive any kinds of training when you started? And as you go down to the benefits or to the business office, and they would tell you things, but were there?
There wasn't much in the way of training back then. It was kind of learn on your own, and you had to work hard, and people were around to help you if you needed it, but there wasn't much in the way of training. I was trying to recall how I knew what I would do for the payroll process. And, it was just filling out some paper forms and submitting them and making sure that they got paid properly. And everyone was paid on a monthly basis at that point. There were no biweekly payrolls. Everyone, and I think students as well as the faculty, staff, and the classified. Yeah, we were all on a monthly basis. That was a big change later.
And did and so you said there was one other staff member in the.
Yes, her name was Jeanette Day, and she came in part time and just helped typing some of the papers. That was primarily her responsibility.
And were you in charge of hiring and organizing the student staff as well, or was that the faculty?
No, the grad students would hire their own.
Did that.
Okay. Yeah, their own students, and the faculty would hire their own. There were no open recruitment requirements back then at all. I mean, it was, you found someone and you hired them.
What was, what were the offices like in Sterling Hall?
My office was you would walk down the hallway, and there were offices on the left where the faculty were, and my office and Jeanette's were on that same side as the faculty. On the other side of the hall were primarily labs. where they were doing research. And then we also, in nuclear physics, we had the whole downstairs area as well. And we named, you know, we had a room called the pump room. And I don't know why it was called the pump room, but and we had a shop down in the basement where they did all the repairs. And there was a fellow there who worked for the university well over 50 years. His name was Mike Murray, and he got an award down at the Capitol one time for, I think, the longest term employee of the university, or of the state even. Yeah, I think he, if I recall, I wasn't there when he passed away, but I think he passed away in Sterling Hall when he was working.
People don't quit.
Yeah. So then the labs across the hall. So then probably the big issue then was what happened, you know, and as I said, I worked with the faculty on a day-to-day basis. They would bring in their work and they would tell me when they hired someone and I would get them on payroll, etc. But then in 70, when we had the Sterling Hall bombing, mm-hmm. I had only, you know, been there about 3 years, and I was working with Professor Barshall on a national conference. So we had all kinds of documentations in my office and his office, and when the bomb went off, it destroyed all the labs that were across the hall from my office. The hallway was still there, so you could stand in the hallway and look down into the basement level, and there had been flooding, of course, and all the research papers and experiments and everything were just a mess. Mm-hmm. Some of those grad students then never did finish and get their PhDs. With the bombing, I didn't know about it except for the fact that it did wake me up when I was in Middleton. It just in the middle of the night, I heard this kaboom, and I sat up. I remember sitting up and saying, "What was that?" And I came into work and discovered that, you know, the whole area had been blocked off. We had to find alternative site to continue with our national conference, so we moved down to Langdon, and I was trying to remember the name of the building at that time. I don't think it was the Pyle Center, but it was right in that area. So we continued on and prepared for that national conference. And it may have even been an international conference. It was a big deal, and it was unfortunate that it happened right when we were working on that conference. But being in Sterling Hall at that time, and the fact that when they set off the bomb in Sterling, they were really after the Math Research Center, not nuclear physics, but they miscalculated apparently, and so then there was a lot of unrest. Well, that kind of stopped the unrest up until the bombing. You know, we had the National Guard on Bascom Hill. There were days when the tear gas was so heavy we couldn't really work anymore. We'd have to go home. You didn't want to walk up to Bascom because it was just a row of National Guard up there and the protesters. I didn't, you know, we never really talked too much about it in the department with the grad students, and I'm sure they talked about it a lot, but I was pretty young and naive at that point. I, you know, it was just like, what's going on? Oh, okay.
I guess you mentioned kind of like you would try to, you know, like avoid where the National Guard was on campus and things like that. Was the mood on campus, did that make it harder to work? Or was it from day to day? Or?
You know, not. I mean, it was a little disruptive because you couldn't always go where you wanted or needed to go, and but we kind of just stayed in our little area down there because we were down the hill from Bascom, so the tear gas didn't really come into our area all that much. Of course, we had to, you know, keep the windows shut and all that, but we just continued on. So when the Sterling Hall bombing occurred, I mean, that was a huge deal, of course, and all the windows in Van Hise were blown out. Many of the windows in the old hospital were blown out. And And of course, we had one person who passed away who was in Sterling Hall at the time. We had one of our postdocs, Paul Quinn, was in the building at the time of the bombing and was in my office and happened to have the door open. Otherwise, that door would have just slammed him right against the wall in my office. And so we talked about how it was a good thing you were in there with the door open, because it was such a powerful explosion. But then it was not too long after that that I decided to, and I was asked to come work in the LNS Dean's office. So I, because it was kind of depressing working in nuclear physics after that and seeing what the grad students had to deal with and the faculty, and everyone was quite depressed. And so then I moved on.
What was it like, just before we maybe get to LNS, just in terms of that work of trying to kind of piece back the department after all of the materials, were just what kinds of things were professors trying to do to recreate their research, or then grad students as well?
You know, they just continued on. They had to relocate some of their labs and try to kind of reconstruct what was going on. Some of the major areas that they were using for research, like where the accelerator was, or there was a room called B101, which was kind of on the other side of the building, and there was another accelerator over there. And that, matter of fact, that's where my husband worked, because that's where I met him, was in Sterling Hall, and he worked for Dr. Herb as well as me. And so he wasn't in the building at the time either, but he had already moved out of the building and to the company that Dr. Herb started. So I think, you know, the faculty just tried to make do with what they had left and reconstruct. And, you know, I just know that some of those grad students then tried to move on and find other opportunities.
And you said you've kept in touch with a number of the faculty in physics over the years.
Well, only the ones that are still alive. There's not many are still alive, matter of fact. It was Professor Richards, Professor Marshall, Professor Blanchard, and Professor Herb that were the four faculty members in our unit. And then we had postdocs, and some of those postdocs did move on to become faculty members in nuclear physics. And I have seen them on occasion, but many of them have retired also.
Right.
So if I were to go down there today, I don't think I'd recognize anyone.
I think mentioned also maybe Professor Pondrum?
Well, Professor Pondrum, he was not in nuclear physics.
Oh, okay.
So Sterling Hall had high energy physics, plasma physics, nuclear physics. I can't remember if there were others. But they were on different floors, so high energy physics was up, I think, on third floor, and I believe Lee Pondrum was part of that group. And so I would certainly communicate with the staff who were working in those departments as well. So it was not centralized. There wasn't a Department of Physics office. We had our little satellite offices. Well, there was a physics office, but it wasn't responsible for all the sub-departments. So we were considered a sub-department, not a department. So you have physics, and then you have these sub-departments.
Interesting.
I think they've changed that now. I think everyone is kind of goes in through the main department office.
Right, because I think a lot of the nuclear stuff is now out of engineering.
Well, there is nuclear engineering.
Right.
I don't know. I think nuclear physics still exists.
But
I'm
not
sure.
But not a sub-department.
Yeah.
It's made a little bit... Okay, so then...
And so one other point I might make, while I was in nuclear physics, I started out as this whole tidal structure business is kind of interesting, in that I started out as a typist too.
Right.
And you could be a typist too if you had 1 year of college. Otherwise, you start as a typist one. And so I was a typist too, and I don't have the exact period of time, but I moved in nuclear physics. I moved from a typist two to a typist three to a technical typist three to administrative secretary one and then administrative secretary two. So they kept giving me opportunities to promote for promotions and rate increases. When I first started working, my salary was $300 a month, which was a lot of money at that time, but $300 a month today is, I don't think, if you make that a week, it seems too low. But but anyhow, they gave me all these opportunities and did what they called reclasses. They weren't really promotions. They were reclassifications based on the fact that I was taking on more and more responsibility.
And this was the department chair would arrange for these? Or?
Yes. Usually it was Dr. Herb who would do it. Yeah, I never had to, if I recall, I don't ever recall asking for a reclass, or they always just gave it to me. They were very nice to me.
And then, just to maybe close the loop on, before you moved to LNS, were you ever able to get back into the Sterling Hall offices before you left, or were you in the alternate location?
See, the bombing was in 70, if I recall, and I moved to LNS in 71. I honestly don't recall. We must have moved back in after that conference was over. We had to move back into the offices there for a short time, or me for a short time. So they most likely were reconstructing the building and getting walls back up and whatnot. So. Because I left there in October of 71, and the bombing was in 70. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we were back. But, those days have kind of faded away. I don't remember those days very well.
So what was the opportunity in LNS that that prompted the move?
Well, when you're in a department, you have to work with the divisions, mm-hmm. and LNS is a division. So they knew of my work, and they just asked me if I would like to come work for them. So, again, there was no open recruitment. So I moved to the LNS Dean's office as payroll clerk too. And while I was there, and I stayed there for until 75, and my responsibilities were primarily working with the classified employees. And classified are, nowadays we don't have classified staff anymore, we have university staff. But back then we had classified staff, academic staff, grad assistants, and postdocs. And one kind of interesting thing is back in when I was in the LNS Dean's office, and even when I was in nuclear physics, we had very few titles. We had faculty titles, of course, and we had teaching assistants and project assistants. And then we had project associates who were the PhDs, mm-hmm. or like today we call them postdocs. But we did not have this wide array of academic staff titles. We were under the state classified server, what they call civil service, classified civil service system. So we had all those titles. And I was classified civil service, being a typist, and we had all the trades, and we had, numerous employees in those titles. But when you look at the, what we call unclassified titles, there were very few. And there were very few until, when I moved into Bascom, we started developing more titles. But up until then, we just had a few titles. It made life a lot simpler than it is today. But there was no salary structure.
Right.
you know, that you could pretty much pay whatever salary you wanted.
Pros and cons, perhaps. So how is the LNS Dean's, the work that you were doing in the Dean's office, different from physics? And
well, it was more personnel work, now called human resources, but back then it was considered personnel. So I was a payroll clerk first, and that was primarily doing the payroll for the classified employees across LNS. So that was all the departments in LNS, all the way from chemistry to zoology, you know, and I don't recall how many departments there are, but those departments still exist.
Yeah.
And so we did all the payrolls for all of them. And all the personnel activities, you know, that was staffing, and since we were under the state civil service system, there was recruitment in that area, whereas in the unclassified side it was pretty loose, but on the classified side there were a lot of requirements, so I had to follow all those requirements. We had position classifications that we had to review to see if someone was eligible for a reclass. We had contracts, so it was interpretation and application of the contracts for the classified. There was merit and probationary salary adjustments. Is in back in the 70s, we got raises, unlike today.
Right.
Yeah, and we got big raises. You know, it was not a little 1-2%. We got big raises. We had fringe benefits, and those all had to be interpreted. We had a $5 million, and that was a fair amount of money at that time, classified budget for College of Letters and Science. And I did verification of funding when a personnel action would come in to make sure the funding was available, because we had funding that ranged all the way from state funds to federal funds to gifts and grants. So we had to be sure that we had enough money, and then we would distribute the unencumbered funds, and those were state money. So if you had a pot of money, and we would review to determine which departments might need a little more money, and, you know, kind of spread it around, especially if they weren't on grant money.
And who were involved in these kinds of deliberations?
Well, it was primarily me and an assistant dean. We didn't have a very large office. We had one person who worked on the, as we call it, the unclassified, and she did that, and then I worked on the classified. So it was separated at that point in time. It wasn't really referred to as professional and unprofessional, or FLSA and non-FLSA. It was the classified had a number of professional staff, and still, although now it's merged, but back then we had professional staff in the classified as well as you know, the custodians and the and the typists weren't really considered professional at that point either.
Do you remember who the associate dean was that you were?
It was an assistant dean.
It was
Phil Certain.
Phil
Helmuth. Helmuth.
Okay.
No, Phil Certain later. I worked with him later.
Okay.
Phil Helmuth. I don't recall who the dean was at that point in LNS.
Is it David Cronin?
No, he came later.
He came later.
I'd have to think back about that because, you know, we were on the second floor of the science of South Pole. And the dean was on the first floor, and we wouldn't really interact all that much with the dean. When I first started working for the university, I had no clue what the structure was. I just thought, oh, I work for this person, and that's fine. But I had no idea, you know, the difference between, well, even faculty, for that matter. But assistant deans and chancellors and vice chancellors, that was not something I even thought about.
I still don't think about very much.
Well, and you don't need to unless you're working with them.
It's a big hierarchy. Did you like working in LNS?
Oh yes, very much so, very much so. And there too, I was reclassified again, and I went from a payroll clerk two to an administrative assistant two, to a personnel technician, and became quite knowledgeable in the area of the classified staff.
Mm-hmm. And again, I guess this is maybe a repeat question, but you know, as you're moving up, are they giving you more
responsibility?
Any instruction? But as you kind of take on these new responsibilities.
I don't recall training that was, you know, it was learning from, I had a lot of mentors who were, you know, whether they were faculty or other staff, that would certainly help. And the other offices around campus would certainly help as well. But there wasn't any formal training going on.
And how did your responsibilities change within LNS as you moved up positions?
Well, you know, you start out doing kind of the basics, and then you just take on more responsibility, and then they give you a reclass, and then you take on more responsibility, and so you're more of an expert, I guess, is how you might, and more independent. All of that is what goes into why you even get a reclass.
And so you said the office itself was, the way it was organized, it was kind of stratified, let's say. So you didn't see the deans very often?
No, I didn't see the dean. I saw the assistant dean all the time, and we had a fairly large office with a number of desks. So we were not in separate little cubes or separate offices. So if you had a question, you just turned around and asked the other person, you know, or you worked together on some of the knottier issues. There were always some of those. We had what we called personnel action forms back then, and they were multi-copy. And they would come in from the departments, and then we would review them, pull off the page, the last page after it was approved, and send it back. And so it was all very, very manual. And then we would have this pile of personnel action forms, and then when it came time to do the payroll, we called it reading the payroll. So we would sit there with this pile of personnel action forms and go through to make sure they were on the payroll correctly. And then that payroll check sheet had to go to the central payroll office, and then they would process the. I'm not sure what they did with all that paper, but... but even before we had personnel action forms, back when I was in nuclear physics, we were working with 3x5 cards. That was our payroll document.
I've seen lots of administrative boxes in archives, but lots and lots of 3x5 cards.
I think they were all imaged at some point, but I'm not sure.
And maybe you could just say a little bit more about what it was like being a staff member at this time, kind of just like being on campus, in terms of the demo. A lot of staff, kind of in terms of like maybe like gender, age breakdown. Were you an average staff member?
There were very few minorities, absolutely, and really. I don't even recall how diverse the, as I think back about who were the grad students and the postdocs, and it was fairly white based. I don't recall that we had much diversity at all at that point in time.
In terms of like age, let's say, were there a lot of was it younger people coming in, people who had been working for the state for a long time?
Well, I only saw, when I was in nuclear physics, I really only saw the, you know, the students, the grad students and the postdocs, and they were relatively younger. And even the faculty were fairly young at that point in time. In LNS, because, and there's certainly an advantage working in a department because you can interact with all these different people. But when you're in a dean's office, it's a paper pushing at that point. Now it's computer pushing, I guess. but back then it was just pretty much paper pushing and on the phone. We spent an incredible amount of time on the telephone because we didn't have emails, and so we would, you know, we would get one of these personnel action forms, and you'd have to pick up the phone and say, "What are you trying to do?" You know, and, but yes, the phone calls were just horrendous.
I can imagine. Did you interact then a lot with, while you were in LNS, so you're interacting a lot with other departments within LNS?
Oh, right, right. Yes, I knew all the payroll folks across the whole College of Letters and Science. I still remember their department ID numbers. I see one and I go, oh, you know, I know that one, that's physics, that's chemistry, that's whatever. You know, you just had to start learning all of that. And with the titles and, yeah, you just became more and more familiar as you worked through it. And I was there 5 years in LNS, and that was long enough to learn quite a bit.
Do you remember anything that was particularly challenging about working in LNS?
Oh, there wasn't a lot of supervision. Now, whether that's challenging or not, all the jobs I've ever had have been very independent. I haven't had a supervisor who's, you know, looking over my shoulder and telling me what to do.
Just the grad students.
Well, they, yes, but you know, them I just I tried to help wherever I could. But and you run into a few difficult people here and there, but I never really felt that way. I always felt like it was a very welcoming place to work and enjoyed what I was doing. You know, they always say if you want to get up in the morning and go to work, that means you like your job, and I've never not felt that way.
That's great. Anything else, I think, about your time in LNS that stood out to you that...
No, I don't think, I'm trying to recall if there was anything. I pretty much covered it, I think. That's it. It was somewhat challenging learning the whole civil service system, that's for sure, but that was a great benefit for later jobs. And that's really why I was, because I did, I guess, a fair job in LNS, then I was asked to come to the classified personnel office, all that. At that point, it was called the non-academic personnel office.
Oh, interesting.
And then later it moved to the classified personnel office. There's always been a lot of question about what the correct titles are, and because we've kind of done away with academic personnel, classified personnel, non-academic personnel. Now it's just all human resources.
Why do you think that is?
People always felt that classified employees were of lower status. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't want to be called classified. And it wasn't necessarily true because there were a lot of high-level professional positions in the classified service, especially in other state agencies. At the UW, we definitely had a few high level, but not as many as those that were considered non-professional. And you know, and that too, everyone's professional. And those terms we've, I think, done away with, which is a good thing, because that makes people feel bad if you tell them, well, you're not a professional employee. Well, of course I am.
I think we have a little time to get into the beginnings of your moves to more to central administration from LNS.
Okay.
So what was the, was it again, word of mouth that got around that we need to poach Carla?
That's kind of what happened. They poached me. So I moved then to the Peterson building and worked with, and that was kind of an interesting time, although I didn't stay there very long, because that was one job that I wasn't real happy with. My job was to do reclassification. So I did travel around campus a lot, met people, reviewed their positions, and determined whether they should be reclassified or not, which, and that was fine. I didn't mind that. But it was a predominantly male office. And they would, it's kind of interesting, they would go for coffee every morning. And it was always the boys that went for coffee. And I said, I'm coming with you. So I would go with them down, I think it was an IHOP.
Ah.
That wasn't very far from the Peterson building, and we would go to the IHOP and have coffee, you know, and that wasn't really very comfortable for me, but at the same time I thought, no, they're not going out for coffee and I'm sitting here working, so I kind of pushed myself into that group. I mean, they were fine, they didn't resent that I was there, but it just wasn't normal.
Mm-hmm.
For a female to be participating in that way back then.
Were most of the employees in that office, had they been there for a long time?
Yes. I was just thinking, there was one other person who was probably younger than me, but other than that, they were all older.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe he was older too. Yeah, I was probably the youngest female that was in a, quote, professional type job at that point. So it was the boys that worked there. So I only stayed there for like 9 months, and I said, you know, I don't like this job very much. I didn't tell them that, I just didn't really. I just had another opportunity to move to Bascom and work in the academic personnel office, and I thought, well, it's a great opportunity. So that's when I moved up to Bascom. Working in the Peterson building is also, you don't feel like you're part of the university.
Interesting.
Now, it's not, I don't feel quite that way here in this building at 21 North Park, because we're right next to a dorm and we see students and we can go over there for lunch, and so we do see students. Although it's still isolated. But Peterson was very isolated. You never saw students or faculty or grad students. It was strictly a business office.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it had business services was there and classified personnel. And I'm trying to think of who else was even there. I think probably research and sponsored programs were there. So it was definitely an administrative building.
Do you think that had an impact at all on the kind of like work environment?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was definitely what I noticed the most was, you know, you had to watch out at 4:30 or you'd be run down. Because people just stuck right to those 7:45 to 4:30 hours. And I wasn't used to that. I would, in L&S, you know, you'd stay until, if there was a lot of work to do, you'd just run out the door at 4:30, you'd stay and do it. So and that was kind of one of the things also that I didn't like about working in the Peterson building. It just, they didn't have the same kind of commitment, I guess, as you do in other more academic units and Bascom. And so it's interesting.
Why do you think that is a little, that you find that in departments and in even in...
Well, because research is never done. And mm-hmm. and the researchers, they stay there all night, you know. So there's always someone around. Whereas if you're in the Peterson, or then back in the Peterson building, if you were only one there, it was kind of creepy. Because there's no one else in the building, and you go, well, I think I better leave too. Yeah, so it was a different atmosphere.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to have a lot to get into once we start with your move up to Bascom. So in the interest of your time, I might wrap up
today. Okay, sounds good to me.
But,
and then I can think about it a little more too.
Is there, before I turn off the recorder, is there anything else I think about the period? So we've gotten up to just a little bit after 76 or so.
Yeah, it was the only other note I had here was when I was in nuclear physics, we did move to the wing green screen computer. I do remember that.
Oh.
Do you even know what that is?
Say more about it.
Wang. It's a W-A-N-G. And it was a green screen, we called it, because it was just a little computer. And so we started into the computer arena. But what I don't recall then is when we actually moved to a higher level. And I think that probably was when I was in L&S that we had. But we didn't use computers much there. So I'm trying to reconstruct, when was it that we really got into computers? And it was a lot of paper for many years. That's all I remember.
Lots of typewriters.
Yes, we definitely had typewriters. And Xerox machines were not really around. So there's a lot of technology changes that we certainly didn't have cell phones.
Hence more typing, I suppose, with
you did a lot of typing. Yes, we did a lot of typing. We did a lot of paper shuffling, approvals by paper and telephone. I mean, that was kind of our day-to-day, depending on what it was we were working on. And in 78, where was I? Yeah, I was up in academic personnel, because I have more information about when I was in academic personnel, the sort of things I worked on there.
This is a bit random, but Campus Mail was active for moving documents around.
Right. I think we had the inter-D envelopes way back then, because that's how we would get all of our work from the departments. They would come in an envelope, or someone would drop it off, but typically it would come through inter-D.
I imagine there's probably a lot more mail.
Yes, a lot more mail than we have today.
All right, I think that's a good place to leave it for now. Okay. We'll pick up next time. We'll talk a little bit more about your moves up the hill. Until then, thank you so much for your time today. This has been really great.
All right, thank you.
All right, started. All right. So today is April 11th. Dreary day in spring. I'm here in 21 North Park in the admin suites with Carla Rotz. Carla, this is the second session of our oral history interview with Carla. Just to maybe get to kind of set things up, we made it to about 1975 or so in your career. Maybe just to test things out with the levels and everything. Before we get into the next round of questions, is there anything about your kind of your early life or your early career at UW that you've thought of since our first conversation that you wanted to make sure is on the record, or if anything else has come up in the meantime?
No, I was thinking primarily of the dates now that we have for this session, so I didn't go back because it was too much.
There's
to
too
think
much.
About for the future.
All right, well then, let's jump back in then. So where we last left off, you were just leaving a position working with non-classified staff in the Peterson Building, correct?
Correct.
To work in the academic personnel office.
I only worked in the Peterson Building with, at that time they called it the non-academic personnel, and then later they called it classified personnel, but I only worked there for 9 months, and I was doing... and I think I mentioned that before, I was doing interviews for reclassifications.
Right.
And then I was asked to move to the academic personnel office in Bascom. One of the reasons was Judy Murphy, who I worked with in the dean's office in L&S, knew me quite well and recommended me to Serena Pondrum, who was an assistant vice chancellor, if I recall, at that point in time in Bascom, and they were experiencing some issues with Department of Labor. Department of Labor wanted to come in and do a full audit, and they weren't really prepared for a full audit. One of the issues at that time was we did not have any full recruitment process in place. So it was then when I moved to Bascom that we started, and I first started out as a personnel specialist, and then I moved from a Somewhere here, I moved from a personnel. Well, I started out as a personnel manager in academic personnel, and then I moved to a personnel specialist, and then later another personnel specialist at a higher level. So they kept reclassifying me. But one of the main reasons I was there was to help them set up a whole new recruitment process. And I don't know if you know about position vacancy listings, but we did not have anything like that. And so we developed the whole position vacancy listing process. We did not have any official recruitment for faculty. And really at that point in time, we didn't have anything for academic staff. It was a little more informal. For faculty, it was very informal, because faculty would go to national conferences, identify someone, and just tell them, hey, I'd like you to come and work with me. Or they'd identify postdocs and then bring them to the campus. So that was not real well received. They then had to start going through a recruitment process. We had to determine, well, what length of time was required. And so all of this had to be documented and put in place for the Department of Labor in order for us to continue receiving our federal funds. And that was a big deal. It was at a time when Ed Young was the chancellor, and Serena Pondrum had been hired by Ed Young. Serena was a little controversial, and I think she'd admit that herself, because she was, I went back and looked, she was, you know, very strong in the women's movement, and but she was a fantastic mentor for me. I felt like I was in school, because she would ask me to write documents, whether these were recruitment documents or whatever, and she would review them and put on them excellent or needs work, or, and I'm going, wow, this is it's like being in school. But so she was excellent for me. Since I had, you know, I only had 1 year of college, and I was fairly good at writing, but she really helped improve my writing style. Then, what else happened during that time? We also, because we were developing the vacancy listings, we took another look at how many different titles we were actually using for the academic staff. And we had a limited number of titles, and so when you recruit, you know, you need to be somewhat descriptive in what kind of position it is. If I recall, that's when we created, because we had one specialist title, and we had one project associate title, which was a non-postdoc kind of title. And so we looked at all the titles, and I kind of blew out the specialist into, I think, 7 different. So we had life science, and we had social science, and, you know, the different areas. So that's when our titles started to grow, as there weren't all that many titles. But we needed that in order to do the recruitment.
Could you maybe say a little bit more? You had mentioned that obviously departments, particularly with faculty, they had their kind of hiring procedures, and that overall that this was kind of, could you maybe say a little bit more about how this was received on campus, and maybe if there were maybe certain departments or colleges that had more difficult times enacting these policies, or?
What I recall the most is, I believe it went to the Faculty Senate. You know, it's a long time ago, but I think there was a discussion at the Faculty Senate, and you know, faculty would say things like, well, why do we have to do this? You know, we can find appropriate faculty members through our other means, and they had to be told that, no, we have to go through this recruitment process. And I think that did not make Serena Pondrum very popular, because she was really acting on behalf of the chancellor. And it was easier for easiest for the chancellor to just have Serena out there as the leader on this mission. And so that didn't go real well. but we had to get it in place. We also worked with, at that time it was the Affirmative Action Office. When I go back and look at the the structure, we had affirmative action that reported to the vice chancellor. We had our academic personnel. We had institutional research and they were responsible for pulling data together. And then we had our non-academic personnel. Institutional research reported directly to the budget office, director of budget and analysis, but the academic affairs vice chancellor, and I could not remember who was the academic affairs vice chancellor, and when I looked, it doesn't identify anyone, so I'm not sure that there was anyone between Serena Pondrum, as I think she was considered an assistant chancellor. We had some different titles back then, but I think she had an assistant chancellor title, but not a vice chancellor title. Later on, we had a vice chancellor that moved into that position, but Serena was reporting directly to the chancellor for this whole process of getting the recruitment set up. Now, the other thing that we were doing in that office, and that was more personnel specialist kind of work, was we would receive multiple copies of what we called personnel action forms, because we weren't computerized.
Right.
And these were tear-off copies. We would review them one by one, write on them if there were changes, and that information had to be transmitted to the payroll office so people could get paid properly. The one thing I remember about this is Judy Murphy, who I worked with, she would always tell me how she would be sitting in her bed at home with the TV on and this pile of PAFs, and she'd fall asleep on top of these PAFs, and I'm going, why do you do that? But we had literally piles of paper for many years, and I did some of that same work in the dean's office in LNS. So those PAFs would be created there, come to the academic personnel office for the academic staff and the faculty. For the classified, I don't recall how that information was transmitted to the, quote, non-academic personnel office, because we were under the classified civil service at that time, so things were a little different. But for the, now we call them either unclassified or university staff, but we have lots of different names now, but for the academic staff and the faculty, we manually reviewed every one of those, and we kept, and they were that chalky material, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So you'd write on it hard and it would transfer through it. And then we would keep those. Hard copies, we would keep those. And send one copy on down to the payroll office. So it was a pretty backwards way of doing business, but at that point in time, people did get paid. And so what I also don't recall then is when computers came into existence, because at some point in time we definitely moved to computerized, but that must have been when we developed what we call IADS, and we can talk about that here in a later year, if I recall.
How were positions before, now there's the jobs that was at EDU, how were positions listed as you're kind of creating this new kind of system? How are they?
It was not a, I'm trying to recall how we did that, but I mean, now we have it, you know, online, all over the world, kind of. I think we, if I recall, I think we asked the faculty to send out notices, you know, and they would have to tell us the recruitment effort plan. That was something we used, a recruitment effort plan, where they would have to tell us how they're actually recruiting. And the requirement of 2 months posting for faculty wasn't initially, I think it started out with 2 weeks or a month, as we had to gradually get this in place without getting too many people upset. But yes, they had, I forgot about that, a recruitment effort plan was something that had to come in now every time they had a vacancy, along with their position vacancy listing. And again, those were all hard copy. You know, so we reviewed the hard copies, and then we would approve the recruitment effort plan along with, at that time, the Affirmative Action Office. So they had to look at it also. And that was part of the Department of Labor audit. So whether we're really openly recruiting.
They might not have sent those notices out to everyone, perhaps.
Well, we don't say no.
So as you're in the APO before you became director, as you're moving up for a couple of years, and I'm just, maybe you could speak a little bit to kind of what your day-to-day work life was like in this office. You reported directly to Serena Podrum?
I did.
Okay.
So day-to-day it was, we were on the phone 90% of the day talking to the divisions, because we did work with divisions. Once you get to a central office like that, you typically work with a division. The division works with the departments. And yes, we talked on the phone a lot. A lot of paper shuffling with this reviewing of the recruitment effort plans and the position vacancy listings and the personnel action forms. So that really took up a lot of our time. Mm. And then trying to figure out, is there a better way?
Right.
And that, I was trying to recall then, the next change was really when Serena, I don't know the exact timing on all of this, but I know that when Irv Shane came in 77, he removed Serena. It was a difficult time because he brought in Bri Curl, who was from the College of Ag and Life Science, and he was great to work with. But I had then, at that point in time, become director of academic personnel, so I was kind of caught in between the switchover from being in the, or reporting to Serena, who had reported to Ed Young, to now reporting to Bri Curl, who was reporting to Irv Shane. And they had different styles, but Bri also was ag journalism. So he was great at reviewing whatever I wrote.
Right.
And he was very, very supportive. Matter of fact, he was the one who submitted a request to move me from, at that time, what was non-academic or a classified title into an academic staff title. I think that was probably the department role. That was in 78, and I found the letter where he wrote to the Personnel Classification Committee.
Wow.
And they had to review what I was doing and whether I was qualified to do that work without a degree. Because at that time, you were supposed to have a bachelor's degree in order to be an academic staff member. So that was submitted to Bob DeRemus, who was, I think he was an associate dean in the College of Letters and Science, but he was also chair of the Personnel Classification Committee. And Bri Curl, and it was, you know, we didn't call people by chancellor, vice-chancellor. It was Bri and Serena, and later when other chancellors came in who had been vice-chancellors first, we did use first name basis, which is a little unusual, I think. It was very informal. So Bri submitted the request that I be moved to, he said, I'm clearly in a major policy-making role in recognition, assumed dramatically increased duties and responsibilities. He wanted to appoint me to a limited position. So limited meant at the discretion of the appointing authority. I became a limited director, and then I had my classified backup. And then they also gave me an academic staff backup, so I had tons of security. So if they didn't like what I did, I'd have to go into one of my backup roles. So that happened in April of 78, and at that point in time, it was talking about how we had a clearinghouse. Oh, I forgot about that. We had a grad student who would make referrals. So I hired a grad student who would look at all the vacancy listings, and he would have, and at that time it was a fellow, he would have individuals who were interested in our positions, and he would try to match them manually to the vacancies that were coming in. So that was called our clearinghouse. We would have to first refer layoffs and non-renewals, mm-hmm. because we had a few of those at that point. We did career-related education, where we developed some guidelines for employees to get tuition reimbursement. This was during the open recruitment. We were responsible for developing and revising the vacancy listing requirements. Mm-hmm. We determined what classification they would fall in, because sometimes they came in and they should be classified and not academic staff.
Mm-hmm.
We reviewed the faculty vacancies for title qualifications, and there's the authorization to recruit or the recruitment effort plan.
Mm-hmm.
We would interpret all the academic staff policies and procedures, and we also did audits of academic staff positions. And then we worked with the dean's offices on all the salary adjustments. We would review any requests for rate changes and degree waivers. Overloads was something else that came to us. So if someone was working more than full time, that had to be approved. If they had title changes, leaves of absence for over a month, I mean, it went on and on. This was all paperwork. Yeah, someone converting from classified to academic staff, or we called it, to academic staff. And then we had just other little things going on, whether it was the student hourly, reviewed the student hourly payrolls to determine whether the students were enrolled.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's all done
computer-wise.
The limiteds, monitor the use of the limited appointee designation. We did the sick leave, vacation interpretation, and then there were some special things I did for the vice chancellor, develop job descriptions and liaison between our office and the classified personnel office, and reviewed current and proposed system policies. So this was back in 78.
Could you say a little bit more about, you mentioned that you did audits of the academic staff.
We didn't do a lot of the academic staff. It was primarily more if they were requesting to move a classified to an academic staff position, we would need to do an audit.
Mm.
Was it really an academic staff position? And there was a lot of judgment as to whether it was appropriate. Was it a policy-making position? Was it independent research, that sort of thing.
So those are the kind of criteria that we...
Right, right.
Interesting.
So.
Of all these many different kinds of responsibilities that your office was charged with, there's some that stick out as more challenging or particular that kind of stick with you as these were more difficult to navigate on campus?
Well, probably, dealing with the personnel policies and procedures, because there was not a lot in writing. Because we were developing and interpreting the policies, and we had about 20,000 unclassified staff at that time. And there was, and I was trying to recall, we didn't have in the employment relations area, because when I look back, that's when the TA strike was in 70.
Mm-hmm.
But we had someone in our office who was, I think it started out with Ed Krinsky and then Charlie Carlson. I don't know if you know those names, but they were dealing with the TAA.
Yeah.
That was always somewhat contentious, and it apparently still is.
Yeah.
You're still looking for salary increases and more job security, and that was always going on. I think when Bri Curl came in about 78 or so, and that was, as I mentioned, when Irv Shane, because he started in 77 and Bri was there in 78, and then Bri brought in, because it got to be too much day-to-day for him to actually supervise the academic personnel office, so he brought in an associate vice chancellor.
Mm.
And that was Mary Ann Udella Smith. And it was a real learning curve for her. And I can speak about her now because she's passed away. but no, she also came from journalism. So mm-hmm. another yeah. excellent mentor who, you know, was very good at writing. And I was still assistant director at that time. So when Bri took me through the classification committee, that must have been when I was made assistant director, not mm-hmm. director. Because she came in, and then she made me director. But she would work directly with Bri, and it was an interesting arrangement where we would identify all the issues back in the academic personnel office, and then she would carry them to Bri, and then she would come back with the answer. And it was somewhat difficult because there was a lot in the interpretation. You know, did he really say that, or did she really say that?
Game of telephone, I see.
So we had, at that time, when Mary Ann was there, I was assistant director. We had mm-hmm. still had the non-academic personnel. We brought in someone, Jack Garner, who was our head of our fringe benefits area. And then we still had affirmative action. And separate from us, there was compliance and, well, they were part of us too. Diane Rausch was compliance. And so that was really, affirmative action was under Mary Ann then at that point. And then Charlie Carlson, who was the TA negotiator. So we all worked together. And we were part of academic affairs, which is kind of a key point because we didn't stay mm-hmm. with academic affairs. Eventually we were moved. But at that point in time, we were still with academic affairs. Let's see, where did we go from there? Then, it's hard to recreate this, believe me.
It's a lot of moving parts.
There were a lot of moving parts, yes. So, then I think, and I'm trying to remember what year it was. Well, about in, so we said that was in 70. I'll lose my documents here so I know what years I had. Okay, then in, became 78, I became assistant director, and then between 78 and then into the 80s, we started developing what we call the integrated appointment data system. Because we were kind of tired of all this paper. So we developed our own system. We worked with DoIT and had some very good programmers. I have a design here of what it was like in 83 and how the paper was flowing. the paper.
It's like a board game.
Yeah, it really was. The PAF would come in and it would go over here and then it would go to the check sheet and then it would somehow get to the budget and then we'd have to bring it back around again for the budget building and then the timesheets, how the timesheets kind of coalesced with the with the personnel action forms. And here's what our goal was. Our goal was to have this little train track that we would enter the appointments, they would get funded, they would get onto payroll and get mm-hmm. the payments, mm-hmm. and then we would pull off the budget at one point in the year and start up the whole process again. So I didn't mention the fact that we also were always reviewing the funding. The funding was a key part of all of the personnel action forms. We had to make sure that there was enough funding to cover the appointments and the salaries. So we started developing this integrated appointment data system, and it was, I'm not sure exactly the year that it went into place, but we had to design and test and train all the users on the appointment portion mm-hmm. of this system. And we implemented it for all of the old Chapter 36 institutions, because there was the old Chapter 36 and the Chapter 37, if I recall. But the merger, when did the merger happen? In 1971, I thought, but...
70 or 71.
Yeah. Yeah. But we were still thinking separate. And so, you know, we had Milwaukee and, if I recall, it was Milwaukee Extension Colleges and Madison. So we were kind of the old Chapter 36. So we developed IEDs for those institutions. And we had hoped that it would eventually integrate payroll, accounting, budget, you know, so it would be that little train track that went around a circle. That never did happen. Mm-hmm. We had our appointment system, and you could get appointed, and that information would be in the computer now, so you could look someone up and see what kind of job they had. Mm-hmm. But it never did quite make it directly into the payroll, or you could actually go into payroll and change the record. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it wasn't meshed. Mm-hmm. Or so, yeah, it was like two separate systems. But at least we had a record of the jobs. And if I recall, we had a separate, you know, I had a list here of all the different, because we had something called, where is it? We had something called a PHIQ, I mean, there was payroll inquiry, there was appointment changes, there was appointment, so you could look up all the information, but they, again, as I said, didn't have to agree with each other. So that was not a good thing, but you know, I have records here of what those old screens looked like, and it was also called the 3270. Mm-hmm. And the 3270 was just put to bed. Would you believe that? That just this last year. We were still using this data from the 1980s to look up records for prior employees, because we had employees, of course, who started back then, and so we needed to track their history. We need to have that information if we're going to do benefit counseling and determine what kind of sick leave they might have what their history is. So this system was extremely important to us over the years. And eventually we'll get to what happened to, well, we did, what do they call it? They didn't call it putting it to bed. They call it, there's a term that they use for it. And I go,
sending it off to pasture.
Yeah. Also, during the 80s, we were, academic staff governance started up, and I was very much involved in working with those academic staff executive committee, and they had comp and fringe benefit committees, personnel policies and procedures committees, etc. So, but I would almost always go to the academic staff executive committee meetings, less likely to go to the university committee or the faculty senate, I'd sit in and to the faculty senate, because they would frequently talk about some of the things that we were working on. But I did not go to the university committee meetings, but I definitely was involved in the academic staff executive committee. So got to know those people real well, and we worked very well with them. We did hire a couple of people in 1980. And that was, or I did, I should say, it was Steve Lund and Amuye Asba. And the whole purpose of hiring them was to do the academic staff review. That was a huge thing. It took us at least a year, maybe 2 years, where we had everyone update their job description. And those all came into our office, and I found my old, they were called PQs. We had, at that point in time, this was a later version, but we had position questionnaires or position descriptions come in for every academic staff position, and Stephen and Mouillet were put in a room in the lower level of Bascom Hall under the chancellor's office, and they spent a year there.
Wow.
Reviewing all of these vacancies, or all of these positions, and created a system that we called the academic staff review, so that when a vacancy came in, it could be reviewed and determine approximately what range salary it should be. Because there really wasn't any rhyme or reason to how salaries were set. So this was part of that process. And we used that for a number of years, until we, and I think the next time in 86, that's when we, I recall, I don't know if we want to jump to 86 yet, but let's see, what are we missing here?
Can I just, so maybe just to kind of give a little bit of sense of how things are working in the office. So there are these different kind of initiatives that come up, whether it's we need to be reviewing academic staff and making sure that the salary correct, or we should think about computerizing kind of our records and our employee listings. What is happening, I guess, amongst leadership? Where are these kind of initiatives coming from, and how are these kind of inefficiencies being identified? And then, what was your role kind of in helping to identify these inefficiencies? And
well, it certainly was within our office. Whether it was, and it just evolved. Because it was like, golly, we're dealing with all this paper. Isn't there a better way?
Right.
And let's bring Do-It in and see if they can help us. Of course, they weren't called Do-It at that time. I think they were just called a computing service or computer.
I don't know what their name was.
But, yeah, it was, we kind of self-identified. What were the issues? And the academic staff review, I think that also came out of that Department of Labor. That, you know, they said, you don't really have a way of determining your salaries. And so they would suggest that we do something about that. And that's why we started that academic staff review. One interesting thing about that academic staff review was Herb Heinemann was in the School of Business. And Don Schwab, if I recall. And they were just down the hall from us. Well, they heard that we were doing this, and they said, boy, that'd be really interesting for you to come and tell our grad students how you do something like this, because it was practical experience.
Yeah.
So we went to their classes, or one of their classes, and described what we were doing. Because, people don't think about how you actually would approach a project like this. But we were fairly well organized. And I don't know if it was because I was more organized, or I had some excellent employees, and we just worked together really well, and came up with, well, let's do this, and let's try this, and let's get this working. And then we worked with divisions, of course, had a lot of contacts with divisions. And I think it helped that I had worked in a division, and I kind of knew, in a department, so I kind of knew you don't just send it out there and say, you're going to do this now.
Right.
You have to do a lot of collaboration and bring them in and say, okay, what do you think about this? This is what... And so we had focus groups, and we didn't call them focus groups at that time, but we had individuals from the divisions that would come and work with us, and we'd show them, like IETs, we would show them, well, what do you think? Is this going to work? Is that going to work? And, it was a big change for people to switch over from all that paper, and I think there were some who still didn't do away with their paper they didn't trust. So they were getting their personnel action forms in, and then they were entering them into IAS. So they had backup documents. But at least, so I don't know if it cut down on the amount of work they had, but at least they had a source for looking at the data, or for the data.
Was there a process where employees were trained into using computers? Part of my reason for asking this is I'm wondering maybe kind of like what percent of staff are actually really familiar with computers at this point that they're being asked to kind of use and to get rid of their paper and start
learning these new systems. I mean, do it, obviously there's computer services in place and they're becoming a bigger presence, but.
Yeah, there certainly was some training because we mm-hmm. had appointment system authorizations and we had data entry questions and we mm-hmm. had, you know, so mm-hmm. we had individuals who would help them. I don't recall, I'm sure we had sessions with them.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have labs, though, back then with computers. So you'd almost have to go to them individually and try mm-hmm. to help them through to learning the system. Yeah, it was... And we didn't have budget for this. I mean, it was
oh, wow.
You know, it's not like today when they go, oh, we got another $80 million. We're going to work on...
Right.
A whole new software
right.
package, and that wasn't, you know, we hardly grew in size. We kind of did this along with everything else we were doing. It wasn't, let's hire a whole new group to come in or a group of consultants to come
right.
in and put in place IETs or to put in
mm-hmm.
place the new title structure. But that ASR review that we did with... determining salaries and looking at jobs, and that also was part of developing some new titles. You know,
mm-hmm.
all of that was kind of together. But that lasted until, and I'm trying to remember when Hayes Hill came in, but then we did have a big consultant come in. Hayes Hill
mm-hmm.
came in and did a whole new, or a whole review of our titling structure. and that was... I'm trying to remember, I think that about in 86 or so, because at some point in time, Mary Ann Udella Smith left and I think went to Minneapolis,
mm-hmm.
To the University of Minnesota, and then, is that when I was made associate? Yes, I was made acting associate vice chancellor between 87 and 88.
Yep.
So that's when she left,
mm-hmm.
and... Then at that point, Phil Certain was brought in to be an associate vice chancellor. So that was over a year and a half that I was acting associate vice chancellor. But I don't know what happened during that period.
before we get to that, maybe
yes.
it would just be good to reflect a little bit just on your time as director. And you know, so you had gone from an assistant director to director and. I'm curious, kind of maybe thinking back, kind of what
changes there were.
Well, how you thought about your role as director, and if you had goals that if when you were assistant director, you know that was kind of a goal of yours to become director. If certain kinds of like things that you wanted to implement and see change in the APO, or if this was You have a knack for kind of just falling into promotions, it seems, often.
And I never had a grand plan for I'm going to be a director, and then I'm going to be this. And I never even thought about it. It was just circumstance, and I happened to be there, and, you know, they apparently thought highly of me and what I was able to do, and so they just said, well, Carla's there, why do we... So they didn't really follow their own open recruitment requirements when it came to me kind of moving up the ladder
right.
to director of academic mm-hmm. personnel. And I didn't see it as a huge change, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I was still working with the same people, although then I had to
mm-hmm.
do the budget, and I had to determine the salaries, and I had to do, although we didn't do very... defined performance reviews like we do now. You know, everyone has to have a performance review. And we did those much more informally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't even think my staff thought of me as a supervisor per se, you know, because I would work right along with them. I was not the one thing I do remember is this woman who was across the hall in institutional research when I was appointed director. She came over one day and said, you know, you should now just sit back, put your feet up on the desk, and think strategically. You know? And I thought, what? How are we going to get all the work done? You know, so different people have different ideas about what it is to be a director, and I didn't think that way at all. I tried to do both, you know, tried to be strategic, but at the same time, I worked right along with the staff all the time. It wasn't like, oh no, that's below me, you have to do that. No, never. That was not how it worked at all.
How big was your staff that you were on kind of like a daily basis of people? I mean, obviously there's a lot of people within this office, but...
There weren't that many. We didn't have that many. I mentioned hiring Stephen Amuye, but they weren't right there while they were working on that academic staff review. Let's see if I have an org chart here that even lists how many people we had. But my recollection is we had someone who was kind of a receptionist, but she did much more than being a receptionist. And we had someone who, and I don't remember if she came later, but in Bascom, we had it was a small office.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, so I'm thinking about how many offices we had. So I had one office, Amuye had an office, Steve Lund had an office, and then we had someone named Sue Baker, who definitely took over a lot of the responsibility for reviewing all the PAFs as they came in. And then we had a couple of reception kind of people. But it was a small operation. Matter of fact, we were in an office that had a huge wall between one set of office where I was and one other small office and then the rest of the offices. So we had physical plant come in and remove the wall because we wanted an inner sanctum there. And we wanted to work together, you know. I don't like walls. And I think in some ways this office is better served when we have cubes than walls. But it was a small office. And it wasn't a huge difference for me to move into a director role, and it wasn't even a huge difference for me to move into that associate vice chancellor. It just meant that now, rather than going through an associate vice chancellor to ask the vice chancellor questions, I could go direct.
Right.
You know, and not that I didn't once in a while go direct and see Bri, but when I was acting associate vice chancellor, then it was a much more direct relationship. And Bascom was a very friendly place at that time. You know, people were going back and forth between offices all the time. It wasn't like, oh, you can't go in that office, or that person's really too busy. I never felt that. And across the hall was the budget office, and so we worked with them all the time.
Oh.
And I can't recall who was in the what's now the Lauren Heller's office, which is the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration. I think that may have been considered the director of budget at that point. It was Glenn Watts who was there. And we had a great time. We did an April Fool's joke on Steve Lund one time. And because the other thing we did, we socialized and took the time to do it. But anyhow, one time, April Fool's, we had a little closet where we all hung our coats. And, we set it up so that Glenn Watts, who was director of budget, he had a police radio. And he set that up so that, I can't remember how it worked, but Steve got a phone call and it sounded like the police were calling him. And Steve was getting ready to go on this big trip and he had his car all packed. And so Glenn calls Steve and says, oh, there's been an accident, somebody ran into your car and all your underwear is all over the street. And Steve went, oh my God. And he goes running to this closet to get his coat. And we had a big April Fool's sign in there.
Oh, that's perfect.
But he didn't see it. So I had to run after him. And I said, April Fool's. And he goes, oh. So I remember that. That was pretty dang funny.
Sounds like a wonderful office.
Yes. We also, we have a lot of stories from our office because I was mentioning Judy Murphy, who also has passed away. I think I told you she passed away, but
yes.
Anyhow, when we were doing that academic staff review, or maybe it was, no, I think it might have been the Hayes Hill, I don't know, one of the title studies, she was so upset that we weren't going to pay attention to how important her job was. And, you know, and one day I was so mad at her, I just went in and said, and I never would do this, I just pulled her on the desk and I said, Judy, don't worry about it, we're going to take care of you. And my staff were like, did you hear Carla? Because that was just unlike me, but I just headed up to hear.
That happens sometimes.
And that was in 81, because I know I was pregnant with my second child.
Oh.
Or almost pregnant with my second child. It was 80. But anyhow, so yeah, we had some good times.
Sounds like a great group of people.
It was. And they've all left. They're all retired. And Catherine DeRubas, who is still here, was hired into that office when Steve and Amelia were still there. So we still have a few people around who remember. But
who still remember the one time Carla raised her voice.
Yeah, I know. I don't think Catherine was there at that point. But Steve remembers that. And Amelia, go, oh my gosh, Carla.
Well, then we have it on record now. So that's good. But you mentioned now, so this move by that you happen to become associate vice chancellor, what kind of brought this about?
Well, that was,
was it a big move, actually? I think now people look and they see that title and they attach it to this provostship in her, and
I know, it wasn't. I mean, it was really just a matter of, now we don't have to, another person that we have to go through in order to go to the vice chancellor's office, you know. So no, it was not a big move. It made it life easier for us, but we did then bring, I shouldn't say we, but then I think Bri Curl brought in Phil Certain when we started with the Hayes Hill study. Because the Hayes Hill study was a huge deal, and that then was really going to replace that whole academic staff review
that we did.
And there was so much controversy over the Hayes Hill study, and the librarians just were unending with their concern over that particular study.
Interesting.
You know, one individual in particular, and she probably would admit it, Barbara Meyer, I remember her very well. She was something else. But anyhow, it was very nice to have Phil Certain come in and kind of take over that responsibility. Mm-hmm. And we had to deal with UW system on the academic staff review, and they weren't the easiest to deal with. There was a fellow named George Brooks, and I was in Phil Certain's office one day, and matter of fact, they were talking about my title in particular, and Phil was just screaming at him. Because, you know, it was a matter of where do you peg these different positions and understanding the importance of these jobs. And Madison was, everyone in the system was part of the Hayes Hill study, so it wasn't just Madison.
Right.
And that was always a controversy as to how are Madison's jobs different than the rest of the system.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, so it was, that was kind of rough times when we went through that whole study.
And I guess just, my guess would be that the system schools would maybe feel that their positions weren't being given the same level of, that they weren't being equated with Madison positions, that they're being seen as less,
not necessarily. I think that was one of the concerns, that they were at a level, and they were trying to put Madison at the same level.
Ah.
When you look at the size of Madison, even you look at LNS or the med school, they are larger than UW Milwaukee. You know, so it wasn't like you were treating apples and apples. It was apples and oranges, or even grapefruit. So you can't And we have that issue today,
right,
with some of the things that are going on. So, yeah, it's it was difficult to make sure that we got the titles we actually needed, and we needed some special titles just for all of our research and grants. And Hayes Hill, you know, developed a structure that was just, I don't know how many titles we ended up with, but it seemed like unbelievable number of titles. And we're still living with some of those titles, except now today they're working on a new title review process.
Oh,
title and total comp study is going on right now. So, you know, my response is, what goes around comes around. So, at any rate, yeah, that title, that Hayes Hill study was... And I wanted to go back and just look a little bit more at that.
Yeah,
and maybe that's where we should go to next. And
That would be, maybe to just, the Hayes Hill sounds like, a great place to go. And so that, maybe just to get kind of all angles of it, can you say a little bit about where this initiative is coming from and kind of what brought it about?
You know, I have to go back and look at that, because I can't recall exactly why we did the Hayes Hill study. It was put upon us. I don't know if the Board of Regents decided that we had to do it, but I need to...
Was it something from the... You had mentioned kind of at various points, like the Department of Labor, too, has...
I don't think they were premier... Yeah, I don't think they were the ones who said we had to do a Hayes Hill. I think it was more of an internal concern that... And it very possibly was, because we did our own academic staff review, and that was just Madison. And that other campuses had their own titles, and so the system was attempting to get us all kind of on the same page when it came to titles. So I think that's why we did the Hayes Hill, but I'd have to go back and take a look at that. There was one other thing that I should mention. During the 80s, in 1985, and I was the creator, but I'm the one who decided we needed what we called the Administrative Development Program. And the first year of that, we were able to get Don Smith, who was at that point a vice president, if I recall. So he came in and did the first year of the Administrative Development Program. And what that was intended to do was to bring in new hires at fairly high levels, and the program then would bring in speakers from the Board of Regents to legislators to just a wide variety to make you become very familiar with what's going on within the university and understand the university and the connections that you can have here. And so we had people from divisions, especially if you had a new associate dean or an assistant dean, we would try to bring them into this program. And that program is still going on today. And Don Smith, as I said, was the first one. And I was in the first session of that. We were called the Pioneer Program. But then from that point on, Joe Kaufman took it over and did it for years, and he loved that program. And it became the Kaufman Administrative Development Program. And so that's one of the things that I'm kind of proud of, that that's still going on. And it's a very valuable program. They tried to unfund it because it takes, I don't know, $15,000 a year. It's nothing.
Yeah.
You know, because it needs a little support as well as the leader or leaders. And they tried to unfund it, and we got people to say, no, this is such a valuable program, we don't want it to go away. So anyhow, that's kind of an interesting thing that happened about in 1985. I think that's somewhere along here when Shalala came in. There was some other interesting things, but that's 88, so we don't want to go there yet.
What year did they try to defund it?
It was more recent.
More recently?
Yeah, it was more recent. Maybe about, I don't remember. I can't remember if it was before I retired, possibly, or shortly after I retired. But it didn't happen.
I was impressed if you have all this time to come up with extra projects on top of everything else.
Well, some of these were kind of fun.
The This is slightly backtracking, but because I'm a grad student, I'm always interested in whatever the libraries are up to. I am curious to maybe a way to just kind of maybe share a couple more thoughts about the Hayes Hill study would be. So what did the librarians not like about? Or what was?
If I recall, they didn't like the salaries, and they may not have liked the titles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I should contact Steve Lund because he dealt with them all the time on this, and Barbara Meyer was something. She was just on us every day almost, to the point where I think they got pretty much what they wanted. But yeah, they were very concerned that they weren't being recognized for the importance of mm-hmm. that job. And mm-hmm. we tried to address the importance of every job. But
right, yeah, of course.
But yeah, there was one other person that I had forgotten about when Ed Krinsky was here and working with the TAA, and then Emroy Bretzman, his name mm-hmm. was, Bretz, we always called him. He had an office down under the chancellor's office, was very well regarded by all the chancellors. He would advise them on whatever they needed advising on.
Oh, wow.
And he was a mentor to me also. I would go down and sit down with him and talk to him every once in a while. He was very, very helpful. You know, and that's kind of how Bascom was. If you mm-hmm. found someone who could really help, and I mean, it was kind of like a father figure to me because I wasn't very old at that point.
Right.
So he was, yeah, he was.
What was Ed's position? Or
he was just like a special assistant to the chancellor, but he also was, I think he was negotiating with the TAA also, or at least assisting mm-hmm. with that negotiation. Yeah. So yeah, he was an interesting fellow too.
Bascom seems like a fun place to be during the 80s.
You know, I was always, and you know, at some point I did move out of Bascom, and I missed it, because it was. But then when other staff moved out also, and now I go back, it's so quiet up there. I can't believe how quiet it is. And it's just a whole different atmosphere now than it was. Because we thought when we moved out that it would be difficult to have those connections, and I see, you know, Mark, who's our now director of HR, he spends all his time up there because they want him up there to talk about this, that, and the other thing. So he's running back and forth all the time, and it was so much easier when we were right there. But I don't know. I guess they ran out of space too.
The other thing that your story about. The librarians just makes me wonder about is that your colleague is ends up taking a lot of these phone calls, and I'm curious kind of just like how what the kind of like the distribution of work was like in your office and kind of how different tasks came to different people, and whether it was very clear that certain things were certain people's responsibilities, or it seems like a very, you know, like cohesive, like there's a lot of teamwork and people are working together on lots of different things. But
right we've definitely, I knew, you know, Emouye, what she was doing, she was, you know, reviewing base adjustments and overloads and I think classified to unclassified, because that went on for years. And then Steve was more involved with the employee relations and, and then, as I said, Sue Baker, because then she was, you know, taking over the whole personnel action, the new appointments, and making sure the funding was. So, yeah, it kind of fell in place. And then if someone was overloaded, we would see if we could get some help. But we worked a lot of hours. There's no doubt. It wasn't a 40-hour day, by no means. It was... I think back and I think, man, for years I worked maybe 60 hours a week at least.
Wow.
You know, and it wouldn't end when you left the office. You would go home and continue. You'd have dinner and do whatever you needed, and then you'd go back to work.
What, I think now, you know, like when I was a staff member, I was always on my email. But you know, that's a lot easier to bring home. What was it like bringing
home?
Yeah,
it was more taking paper home, you know, to review this and review that. And
okay.
Yes. Yeah. I guess we have to find out, when did emails start? I don't know.
I'll have to look that up for next. I'm sure.
Yeah, when did we start with emails and?
I've seen photos of one of my old professors in the UW archives, and he made a newsletter in around like I think it was a UW newsletter in like 95 or so for teaching students about email. But I've to do some research into when this actually happens.
Yeah.
We're just at about the hour, a little over an hour mark, and so I think maybe we'll save you taking over as HR director after being vice chancellor maybe for next session.
Okay, that sounds good.
It seems like a good break, but before we wrap up, are there, so we've gotten up to about the 1988, I think is when you take over as HR director, but so kind of reflecting back on the late 70s and 80s, is there, and kind of just in these different projects you were working on, is there anything else that we didn't get to talk about that you would wanna, or any person, any
interesting characters?
we've gotten to a lot of them already, which has been fun. And it doesn't, you know, make it.
Yeah, I can't think of it. I've been trying to take notes when things come to mind. Much of this is probably moving into the director of human resources, because
right.
That's when I would start doing a few other things that were different from when I was director of academic personnel.
Right.
And there was a time, and I guess I don't know exactly when that was, when I was reporting to both the vice chancellor, now called the provost, and the vice chancellor for finance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a juggling act, but you know, people had to try to get along, and so.
Right.
You would never know, do I go to this one or do I go to that one? But I don't know when the vice chancellor for finance was actually hired. That was John Torfey. I think he was the first one that I reported to part-time,
mm-hmm.
and I was still reporting to the vice chancellor. But I'd have to go back and look at that and try to figure out if that was when David Ward was vice. Because David Ward, before he was chancellor, he was vice chancellor.
Mm-hmm, right, right.
And Bernie Cohn was another one that I worked very closely with. I mean, I had such great people to work with in Bascom that they were just so supportive. You know, I see them,
mm-hmm.
if they're still around, I see them today and they give me hugs and they, you know, they were very, very friendly.
Well, if there's nothing else, for now we'll pick up next time
as
director of HR. But in the meantime, thank you so much for your time. This is
You're welcome.
Great. All right. So today is May 7th. My name is Isaac Lee. I'm here with Carla Rotz. Going to be starting our third session of what has been. Interview talking about Carla's career here at UW-Madison and all the positions and accomplishments she's had in her long tenure here. At the end of our last session, we were in the midst of discussing her tenure as Associate Vice Chancellor. So it was around 1988, I believe. And so I think to start off, if you have, maybe we can start off with any other reflections you have on your period as vice chancellor, then we can get into your transition to director of HR.
Okay. So I'm not sure we covered this, but so I'll...
Yeah.
So in 1986 is when we did the Hayes Hill study, which
right.
was a title study, and that's when Phil Certain was the associate vice chancellor. And after he made his way through that quagmire of the Hayes Hill process, it was determined that we no longer needed an associate vice chancellor, although they asked me to be acting associate vice chancellor, which I was then for a period of time. I didn't look to see how long here. I think it was like a year and a half. And then it was decided, you know, we don't really need an associate vice chancellor. We can have the director of human resources going directly to the vice chancellor. A combination at that time of the provost and the vice chancellor for finance. So I think one of the questions was, you know, how were you approached about taking the role? Well, Phil Certain was leaving, and he said, why doesn't Carla just do this? We don't need an intermediary between human resources and the vice chancellor. So that's how I kind of fell into that position. And then during that time, we were developing, because things were not computerized very well, and so we had started to look at a whole new, this integrated appointment data system. And we went live with that in 89. And that hung around for a number of years, but that was kind of one of our main focuses, was to get IADS up and running. We also, and I was trying to remember exactly how this happened, but we had something called the Frankel decision. And so between 89 and 94, we had to review about 700 employees, and we identified some inequities. We had 229 who received back pay that totaled more than $2 million. And then there were 21 appeals of those back pays, and all that was negotiated and resolved between 89 and 94. So that was a pretty active period when we were working on kind of straightening out the title structure. During that period, Bernie Colin was chancellor for part of the time I was there, and I had worked with Bernie between 84 and 86 when he was vice chancellor, so I knew him quite well. And so there was a fairly close working relationship between our office and the chancellor's office, which was on. And one thing about Bernie that was very different from who was before him, Irv Shane. Mm-hmm. Irv Shane really was very interested in doing personnel. He was into a lot of our personnel issues, whereas I think when Bernie came, and then later when Donna Shalala came, they were kind of like, no, leave that up to Office of Human Resources. But mm-hmm. that was kind of an interesting time when Irv Shane was wheeling and dealing with some of the divisions, the deans and the directors. So it was always, well, what did Irv do today? Mm-hmm. Also during this time, the academic staff started, their governance structure became more pronounced, and I spent a lot of my time going to all of their meetings, whether it was the Academic Staff Executive Committee or the Assembly. So we worked very closely with them, and Steve Lund, who was one of my key employees, he kind of took that role over eventually, but that was always our goal, to spend just a lot of time working with them. And it prevented all kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. Because if we didn't tell them what we were doing, they would kind of run off and get all upset about things. And so it was a good thing for us to do that. Now, we also had, you know, the TAA was still, I think, pretty active then, so we had Mike Rothstein, who was doing something similar with the TAA, and so it was always our goal to kind of keep the lines open with them and collaborate much more than I think some others thought we should, but we did, and I thought it was beneficial for us to do that. So we went live, as I said, with IADS in 89, mm-hmm. and when Donna Shalala was there, she did delegate much more, as I mentioned. She also, and I don't know if I've mentioned this before, how she insisted that I go to the Harvard Management Institute.
No.
Yes, I had little boys at home. And I argued with her, and I said, no, I can't leave my little boy. She said, oh, take them with you. I'm sure they have daycare. And no, I'm not taking them with me. So anyhow, I ended up spending 2 weeks at Harvard for the Management Institute. And it was an interesting experience, but I discovered that those who were leading the courses didn't know any more about governance and how to deal with HR than I already did. But you know, I met some interesting people, and I guess it was a worthwhile experience, although I cannot find the certificate that I got from Harvard.
Did Chancellor Schley have any other employees go to this?
No, I was the only one.
She
insisted
you.
That I go. I think my boys were about, I don't know, 7 and 10 or something like that, you know, so... then, you know, I think one of the questions on here also was, you know, did I have some long-term employees? And I definitely did. I had mentioned Steve Lund, mm-hmm. I had Amulya Aspa. They were both hired back when we started with the academic staff review before mm-hmm. we ever had Hayes Hill. And they stuck with me forever until they both retired. We had another woman, Renee Schuchart, and... And went to Schwister, and I don't know, she had married a couple times. Now, she also was one of our key administrative assistants during that time until her husband was a track coach and they moved to Oregon. So anyhow, that was, I think those were probably the two key employees that, and we had good times. We didn't work every minute of the day. We laughed a lot, and we even took time to go after work sometimes down to the German house. And,
Essenhaus.
Essenhaus, yes. And I see they're going to destroy it.
Yeah, they're closing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Now, David Ward, when he became chancellor after Donna, was in 93.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of interesting how, because he was vice chancellor for a number of years, so we knew him quite well as vice chancellor. And sometime during this period, our reporting switched from, well, it was, I had multiple reporting. I had both vice chancellor for administration and the provost, although it wasn't even called the provost at that time, vice chancellor for academic affairs. And then eventually, I moved over to the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration, and that was John Torfey. and he was excellent. I mean, he was... there's no boss that I've had that really was not very supportive and mentoring, and, you know, he was excellent until he retired. And then when David took over as Chancellor, I have to admit, he was different
mm-hmm.
as chancellor than he was. You know, you could still go in and see him, but he was so much more intense when he was chancellor. He was much more relaxed when he was vice chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
So we found that kind of interesting that would happen.
Why do you think that was?
I think it's just the pressure of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think when you're vice chancellor, you have the chancellor who kind of is first stop, and
right.
Yeah, and you can kind of, you can work with the deans more, and
because mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he worked a lot with the deans, and so in 94 I did a 5-year review with John Torfey, and if I recall, I had to do some special where people were interviewed regarding me, and you know, I forget what that was called, but it was very kind of an intense period when I had to put all kinds of information together and they had to rate me, and I forget what this thing was called. It was some sort of leadership managed, it's called an MDP, but anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a list of individuals who actually reviewed my performance, and all during this time the org chart was, it seemed like it changed every year, you know. that's when International Faculty and Staff Services became part of Human Resources, so our office just kept growing and growing, you know. Originally, I started out with just academic personnel, of course, and then I took on what was called classified personnel, and then we changed names, and then they, I'm trying to remember what they became, what title or name they were. I think they were called the non-academic personnel for a while. So the name changes were kind of interesting over the years. That's still classified personnel. And so that was a fairly large organization because classified personnel dealt with all the classified civil service, although it had to be made clear that all of us are civil service, not just the classified. Yeah, people kind of forgot that. Now, we no longer, of course, are part of the state classified service anymore. So we took on international faculty and staff services, and then also professional development and training, kind of geared up. We worked a lot with the Equity and Diversity Office, so on a daily basis, and we were all located right in Bascom, so on a daily basis we worked with them, especially when we developed, you know, the whole new recruitment system that I think I talked about last time with requiring posting of positions, etc. So we did work with that office in managing all the recruitments. I think I mentioned that we had a grad student who helped us with placing employees. What else happened during that time?
Can I ask? So
sure.
I often, in my own experience, kind of on campus, that as people tend to move around a lot between positions, and either for the raises or for just for different challenges, is that, how does that relate to this process that you're kind of overseeing of kind of implementing and standardizing titles more? That, does that make it easier for people to move around?
Well, it made it easier to be promoted within, so you didn't have to move around. We had, when Hayes Hill came in, we had levels, you know, assistant, associate, senior, and distinguished. So I think it helped settle employees down a little bit more so they didn't have to move around. Nowadays, today it seems like people are moving around all the time, and I think that's because we haven't had raises.
Right.
But back then, we had a lot of good raises. Because I look back and I see, you know, we get 7-8% in a year, and which was incredible. Because when I first started working, I was making $300 a month. Or was I even making that? I think I was making $300 a month. But through time and all these movements that I made, my salary kept going up, 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 up.
Right.
And eventually it leveled off when the state stopped providing so much money for the raise. So it's now, it kind of forces employees to move around in order to get a raise, because there's not much, what do they call it? There's a fund for discretionary performance.
Right.
Well, that fund's not very large, and only a few people get it, and there's not much in the way of pay plan, and you know, so I think the title structure, that Hayes Hill title structure, did help with that, although the number of titles just blew up, you know, into the hundreds, which was a little more difficult to administer than having a limited number of titles. I was looking at, you know, back in 99, some of the things that I was doing outside, or not outside of the office, but on behalf of the office, was we had a UW Processing Center board, and so I would be members on that. I worked with UW System a lot on some of the initiatives, and that's probably one of the reasons then that I was pulled in to work on the Lawson Project, because I was pretty familiar with how what we used to call personnel worked at that time, and I was familiar with the UW System as well. So so that's when I started working on the Hayes Hill, on the Lawson Project.
Right. Which was, so that that started in 2001, correct?
Right.
And, but had there been, before, you know, so you joined in 2001, there had been, from my understanding, there had been, for a couple years before, an initiative on campus for the kind of work that the Lawson Project needed to do.
When Wiley was chancellor, his idea was to develop our own, and I think I may have mentioned that to you, and work with the other Big Ten schools and develop our own system. That never happened. So as a result, and it was more difficult because we were now part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
It was easiest when we were not part of the system, because then we could do what Madison needed, not what other campuses needed. And so it was helpful that I was on the Lawson project team in that I could bring to the table what Madison needed. But even today, that's an issue because, well, you would probably get there, but at some point, you know, we were responsible for the service center here in our office. And once we, Lawson was thrown out after about 4 or 5 years, and we went into PeopleSoft, then it was determined that our office, or Madison, would be responsible for the service center. And the service center implemented PeopleSoft. And the service center, because they were located right here at North Park, it was easier for us to kind of influence what we needed for Madison. Because what Madison needs is certainly not what Eau Claire needs, or Platteville, or, you know, some other school. And so that was helpful, that, and I was still director at that time, and so I was responsible for the service center as well. So that happened, somewhere here. Lose track of my dates. But in January, so I worked on the, we called it the APBS project when we were working on Lawson. That's the Appointment Payroll Benefit System project. And then I, in January of 2006, we reorganized OHR, and that's when we brought in the service center, the Employee Comp and Benefit Services Office, so that we had them with us then here at North Park. We also started moving people around, because up until then, the payroll office and the benefits office was in the A.W. Peterson building. They were in that building until they were ready to destroy it, and so they moved over here to North Park. And so that's how we kind of all came together at that point in time. And some of the people in Bascom moved down here as well to North Park. So, yeah, we had February of 2008, we had 14 staff join us at North Park to work on the HRS project, implementing PeopleSoft. So we were here working on the PeopleSoft project until it went live in 2011.
So in the midst of all these different, I think kind of these projects and these that you are, you're involved with as director, do any of them stick out to you as being particularly memorable or challenging, or that at the time you were really excited to be on, for example, the Lawson Project? Or,
well, it, being on the Lawson Project was difficult until I determined that I couldn't do both jobs, because I was doing both. I was out at Research Park, and that's where the Lawson Project was. The project team was located. And then I'd have to come back to campus fairly frequently and try to keep the office here running at the same time. So that was a difficult time. So when I determined that, you know, it was a little too much, then Steve Lund took over as the acting director until Lawson Project was discontinued. And so then I came back into the role of director. Now, it was not an easy time when we implemented PeopleSoft. And matter of fact, assumed the responsibility for the whole service center, because all of a sudden my staff was growing. And I didn't think too much about it at the time, but now when I look back, I go, wow, it must have been a rough time. And it was. Because I think from the time I started working on the Lawson Project until I actually retired, there was never a 40-hour week. I mean, I was working 60 to 80 hours every week, because I would come here, work during the day, go home, have dinner, and work until 10, 11 o'clock at night, and then come back. And I was constantly working. So it was, and that's different than today. I don't see many people doing that today. And I don't know if it was because I was nuts. But I know Steve London and Mouye worked incredible number of hours, because we would stay in the office and work till 5, 6 o'clock every night and then go home and work some more. But the younger generation doesn't do that. I've noticed that. Because now it's 4, 4:30 and I'm all by myself. When we did the restructuring, you know, we had, back in before 2004, we did surveys and we had focus groups, and we had to figure out how to restructure and include the service center and all that. All that was part of the determination that we had in reorganizing. So the service center then became part of us. We didn't call it the service center then, we called it just Employee Comp and Benefit Services. They became part of HR back in 2004, and we were, during this time, we would have to do updates. We'd have group meetings with all these, you know, the division had to know what was going on, and we tried to involve them, and so we did a lot of updates with our staff, as well as going out to the divisions and just letting them know how we were redesigning our workflow.
Did that involve, so as you're rolling out the service center, does this involve Do It as well, or are there, the technology side internal to HR at this point?
Yeah, we certainly worked with Do It and had a lot of close ties with them. Way back when we were working with IEDS, back before, in the early 80s, we were very close with Do It, because they were building it while we were telling them how to, what we needed. Now, Do It definitely was part of the PeopleSoft project. I'm trying to remember how much we actually worked with them. There were a number of people that have also now retired who definitely worked with us during that period of time, and became very familiar with personnel, so it was like, well, we need this, and they'd say, oh, okay, we'll go up and we can do that. Whereas PeopleSoft, we had all the consultants, and it was difficult with consultants, because even though they had worked with other Big Ten universities, they did not necessarily know how the university, how our university worked. And so we're a little odd.
I've heard that many times.
Different.
From consultants.
Not special, but different. As an example, in PeopleSoft, they have this concept of a position, that you fill the position, and that person leaves, and you hire another person to fill that position. And we said, that's not going to work for us, because that means that that job description is supposed to stay the same. And we have way too many jobs where one person leaves and we completely remodel, redesign that job, especially in the research area. Now, maybe if we had all custodial staff or something and said, you all always work in Sterling Hall or, but so we could not use PeopleSoft's concept of position. And that kind of turned it upside down, and also resulted in us having to develop all kinds of front-end systems. Because not only were we different in that regard, but we also were very decentralized. Mm-hmm. And PeopleSoft is designed to have a very centralized structure, and everything comes through a central office. Well, there was no way that we could do that. And so that's why we did develop all these front-end systems, so that we could build in edits and prevent all kinds of errors from being entered and then feed it into PeopleSoft. And so we still are with that today. So there's what we call GEMS with it, which is a front-end system for it kind of starts with the vacancy, et cetera. But then also we have the rate and title. And, you know, those systems have definitely prevented a lot of errors. As I cannot imagine, because with the turnover that you mentioned, you have turnover and the training is not as good as it should be. You know, we did training on PeopleSoft, but since then, a lot of turnover and things have changed, and also we depend on the service center for the training, except for our own systems. And as a result, there's not as much training as should happen. And so if we didn't have the front-end systems, we would be up the creek, to be honest, I think.
There, can you think of any other aspects of UW that were particularly challenging for PeopleSoft and for the consultants to try to fit the software to this institution?
Well, the one thing also is that we went with PeopleSoft, the shared financial system, first.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mistake, in my view, because the funding was out there and using the system in a different way than we wanted to use it for HR. Really, and I think they're certainly thinking about another ERP and another consultant, etc. That, and I don't know if PeopleSoft would be the chosen one, but this time around, I think it might be done a little better in that we would do it jointly with the finance area. Mm-hmm. The other area is the information system, student information system.
Right.
Completely separate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as a result, you have a student who comes and they're put into they're registered and they have their whole file in the student information system, but then they take a job. There's no connection at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, well, why do I have to change my email in both places? You know?
Mm-hmm,
and that's because it's not connected.
Right.
And it's, we kind of have a halfway connection with the finance system, but
TREMS, right? Is it the finance system?
Well, it's SFS, Shared Financial System.
Okay.
Yeah. Now we have TREMS. Now that's another new system, a front end that was built here for the recruitment aspect.
Oh, right.
So you go through the recruitment aspect and, you know, get all of the the I-9 and the the criminal background checked and all that stuff. And then you move into GEMS, where you get your job set up.
Right.
And then that's fed into HRS. And at that point, you go in and you do your funding.
Mm-hmm.
So it eventually gets there. It's kind of the design I had in 1983.
Board game.
Yeah. But we still have, and this is why I think our current vice chancellor, or provost, no, it's our vice chancellor, who's looking more at another system, because he's thinking we have too many front-end systems, and they all cost money.
Right.
So we'll see whether that helps, you know?
Right.
What goes around comes around.
That I wanted to quickly go back to one thing you had mentioned earlier, that one of the other complicating factors was is the fact that the UW system and matching UW's needs to those of the system schools. And this is probably, I think, but throughout, it seems like from early in your director to the Lawson Project to these other sorts of things. I was wondering if maybe you had other thoughts on that.
And I was trying to remember when we actually merged with the system.
The system merge happens under Harrington, I believe.
Yeah,
so
that was way back.
It was way back, but then there's been stages where, you know, more campuses have been brought
in. True. And So the old employee or the mm-hmm. payroll and benefits office, which was in the Peterson building, they were serving both. They were serving both the Chapter 36 and the Chapter 37. So when you look at the statute, mm-hmm. we're in the Chapter 36, which is Madison, Milwaukee Extension Colleges. I forget if there's anyone else, but anyhow, Milwaukee's mm-hmm. part of that. And then Chapter 37 were the old, what we call the old teacher colleges, and mm-hmm. then they became universities. And so our payrolling office was serving both. They had the information coming in from both Chapter 36 and 37, and they had to try to figure out how to deal with both of those. So when we went with PeopleSoft, that was the time when everything merged together and there was only one payrolling system, one benefits system, although benefits is controlled primarily by the state. But, mm-hmm. That's why when we took over the service center, it was more difficult because now we were dealing with all the other campuses. We weren't just dealing with Madison. And that was definitely probably one of the more difficult because the other campuses, you know, and I always heard rumors and I never really knew how true they were, but there were a lot of rumors about, oh yeah, Madison thinks they're special and they need everything and we are just out there and nobody cares about us. And so when the service center moved away from Madison and went over to their new facility over there above Panera, things changed a little bit also in that now we are one of 30. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if we have special needs or not. Mm. It's like, well, we'll check with Eau Claire and see if they need that also. Well, Eau Claire might not need that because mm-hmm. we have all these gifts and grants and grad students and, mm-hmm. you know, we just are completely different. And I think I may have mentioned, you know, Milwaukee is smaller than med school and LNS, each, mm-hmm. not just one mm-hmm. of the colleges. So it's not like the size of Milwaukee makes them equal to us because they're smaller than one of our divisions.
Yeah.
Although Milwaukee is a little bit more like us because mm-hmm. they're larger, and colleges in some ways is more like us because they were so, and still are, so decentralized with all their centers and now colleges around the state. So I think that has been difficult, and it still is. And so I think when they're looking at this new project, they're looking at doing Madison first. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how well that's going to go over, but they're going to try to work with UW System Administration in determining who's going to be the next vendor mm-hmm. and how it's going to be mm-hmm. Designed. But Madison, it's going to be built for Madison, mm-hmm. at least that's my understanding. So it works for us.
Interesting. Were there, do you remember, for example, on like the Lawson project, any instances where that tension kind of flared up between, you know, system schools and Madison?
You know, not too much because we did, they didn't view me as, well, they knew I was Madison, mm-hmm. but because we had the other schools come in regularly and we would show them what we were doing, designing, etc. So, because it was intended for Lawson to be system-wide also.
Mm-hmm.
So they seemed to be somewhat receptive and we would have system-wide meetings. And mm-hmm. I feel that that has, the goodwill that we had back then has not necessarily continued.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's hard to know why. It's just...
Yeah.
A lot is in who's talking to whom and how they're approaching it. And
it's complicated.
It's complicated, yes. Everything around here is complicated.
Were you the only... Who else from UW-Madison was on the Lawson team?
I'm trying to remember. We had Brad Krause, but I think he came from Extension.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, we didn't really have any other Madison folks there. And it was a small team.
Small team.
It was, you know, we had kind of an HR, benefits, and payroll. And payroll was from the payroll office. And Brad, I thought, was from Extension. I'm not sure. But then we were... And as I said, it was a small team, even with consultants. There were only like 3 or 4 consultants plus us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a lot of work in that 5 years, even though it never went anywhere. It only cost $26
million. Only.
And then PeopleSoft cost $86 million. So I don't know what the new project is going to cost. I hear estimates, but I won't even repeat those.
Very, very different from our earlier interviews when the budgets you're getting to develop your staff.
Yes. Yes, our budget was, you know, minimal.
You mentioned that, you know, as your tenure, over your tenure at HR director, your office keeps growing and growing. You keep having more staff under you. What's that been like?
Well, you know, I always said I'd hire people who were smarter than I am. Because you need to do that, and you need to trust them to do their jobs. I was not a micromanager by any means, but I also was a hands-on kind of person. I, you know, if there were issues, I just dug in and helped. I wasn't just spouting orders. And it's hard. It's always been hard for me to just kind of step back and let everyone else do the work, which I did. But I want to know what's going on. And I was always available to take calls from divisions, and I still, even today, I take a lot of calls from divisions and work with the divisions when they can't find someone else who will help them. But there's been so much turnover now that the old gang is not there anymore. But yeah, I think you just had to kind of go with the flow and... And I always, as I mentioned before, I always had good supervisors, so I never had to worry about getting support. And there were times when we had some individuals who got very upset with us because we wouldn't approve something for them or whatever. But I remember, you know, Hector DeLuca. You've always heard of Hector. Yeah, I knew Hector quite well. Well, I haven't talked to him now in years, but yeah, he'd get upset with me. If we didn't give him exactly what he wanted. But then he got to the point where he invited me to his annual party. So, so you know, so it was a matter of just getting to know people and working with them. There was one document I looked at here, you know, I called it linkages. And that was always kind of our key role, was to link with all the other offices and to link... You know, whether it was I have with System Admin, with the Big Ten personnel, with ASIC and the governance and the university committee and the faculty governance, you know, and DO-IT and the secretary of the faculty, the academic staff, legal services. I mean, we worked with all these people regularly, and it was in our best interest to get to know them well, and they would support us and we would support them. So that was kind of one of my... main goals here was the human resource linkages.
That's interesting. Do you think over the years, because I think that is an important part of kind of when I think about campus and how it works is the relationships people form.
Right.
Do you think people on campus have gotten better at that or worse?
I don't think it's better. You know, it's because the office has grown so much, I think it's more difficult to do that today. Because you're so, especially now the director, you know, he spends a lot of time just meeting with the vice chancellor. So as a result, he doesn't have the time to go out there and meet with all these people. And I mean, he certainly tries. I mean, it's not that he doesn't want to do it or try to do it, but now it's not... it's on a need basis now more than just trying to retain those relationships. Mm-hmm. I think the relationships are what helps make the office better. Because if you have turnover in legal services and you don't ever meet with them, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you're calling them and saying, you got to help us, and they're going to go, well, who are you? Yeah. but we also, we met weekly with legal services, with who else? Affirmative Action was in that meeting. I think they may still have some of those meetings, but of course I'm not mm-hmm. involved in that anymore. But yeah, that those meetings were important to have in Bascom, mm-hmm. and it was kind of the worker, not really the worker bees, but you know, the kind of the managers of those mm-hmm. areas who knew what was going on, who knew and hit cases that were going to blow up. You know, we would always talk about the one that was going to hit the newspaper.
Right.
So you'd want to try to prevent that before it happened. but even going to the Big Ten meetings was an important, and I did that for a lot of years. And it, initially, the Big Ten meetings were at the other universities, and we would go for 3-4 days and just visit and see what their university was like. And then, and this is what's happened all over. You know, their budget got cut, and ours got cut, and so we ended up just going to the Big Ten. Center in, at close to Northwestern down here mm-hmm. in Chicago, and you'd go for a day and a half at the most, sometimes just for a day. And so you didn't get to know the Big Ten directors, whereas when I was there, you know, you get to know them, you could call them and say, how are you dealing with this, or mm-hmm. dealing with that? And that that population also changed drastically. When I first started, I was the only woman.
Oh, wow.
And then by the time I stopped going, it was almost majority were women. You know, so it was, yeah, it was interesting times.
How do you, I think particularly I'm thinking now is you've been in your role as HR director, and you've been very, you're very, very keyed into kind of the work culture on campus. But how do you think that's changed? You mentioned a little bit, you know, young people like me are out of here at 4:30, but...
There still are a lot of devoted mm-hmm. folks out there, but I find that the ones who I can mm-hmm. send an email or call at 5:30 are the ones who've been here quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The newer generation just doesn't... They have... And they're probably right. They have better things to do than to work, mm-hmm. you know? But again, it... But then also, if that's your attitude, then it's a little harder to mm-hmm. grow in your position and to take on more responsibility and prove that I'm really interested and, you know, mm-hmm. you could promote me to something different.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think, and people today will ask for raises. I mm-hmm. never asked for a raise in my life. And that's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll go into the supervisor and say, you have to pay me more, because I'm looking at this salary and this salary. And I'm like, whoa, where did that come from? But that's the way they get ahead, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it varies by division.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a small division and you have more camaraderie with your employees and you spend more time with them, and not that you need to know every, because I always tried to stay away from
mm-hmm.
personal lives, and because I've seen where other supervisors have become more familiar with some individuals than others, and that becomes a real problem, because then they think, well, you're promoting so-and-so because you
mm-hmm.
like that person and you've spent time with them. So you do have to separate yourself from personal lives, but it doesn't mean you can't, like I said, go to the Essen House once in a great while and
yeah.
with the whole
mm-hmm.
office, but you just don't go to lunch with the same person every day,
mm-hmm.
and you don't, you know, so you have to be a little more careful with your relationships. But it's interesting to see. I don't know how this new project is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
That will be interesting too. I don't know if I'll be here to watch it. Because they're saying it'll be 5 years, and I'm going, 5 more years?
5 years.
I don't think I'll be here 5 more years. But But, you know, I know I'm kind of going off subject here, but even now, you know, they need someone who has the past experience to help them out. Like, right now I'm working on budget. Well, I did budget back when I was director, and that's changed quite a bit since then. But so I have to pick it back up and try to figure out where we are, and we got a lot more employees, and I don't know who the people are anymore. You know, we have so many of them, and they're coming and going. So anyhow, they need support in that regard as well. But at the same time, the new people have to start figuring out how to do these things.
Right. Has that ever been a tension in your career that you've noticed between the kind of, particularly I'm thinking in your leadership roles, between kind of appealing to traditions and kind of the ways in which things are done on campus versus
the new way,
the new ways to do
things?
Oh,
yes, I hear that on occasion.
Because I worked myself, you know, I worked in an office that had a couple of staff members that had been there for a very long time and had ways they wanted to do things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I come in, I'm one of these new people that has different ideas.
I know. Why are you doing it that way? I do try to change in that regard. I do find myself being probably more helpful than some of the other staff because I'll get a call and they'll say, oh, I don't know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just say, well, there's a knowledge base document out there and here's the number.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do that. I just say, well, let's go through it and then I can send you the KB so you can follow it as well. But I spend a little more time with them, and that certainly seems to be much more appreciated than figure it out on your own. And I think that is kind of the attitude now. And also a lack of understanding of how difficult it is to be in a department where you are not just the HR person. You know, you're helping the students, you're doing the grant money, you're typing, I'm not typing anymore, but you're keying in documents for them. And it's very different than being specialized like someone in this office. Because I will hear, well, so-and-so, she doesn't know anything, you know. And I'm going, you know, she's got all these responsibilities. And it's a small office. And in a small office, it's more difficult than in a big office. Because in a big office, you can specialize. But those little offices out there, they've attempted to create hubs and have multiple offices and go through an administrative staff. It hasn't worked real well because the faculty don't like that.
Yeah.
They want their own person. You know, they don't want to have to go to a central office where they don't know the staff. And
yeah. Have they ever tried that or they
implement
that?
Yeah, Kales has tried that a few times. SMPH, now the med school, they have a huge reorganization out there. Where now they have like 30 HR people centrally.
Oh, interesting.
And then they're assigned to different departments. So I don't know how that's really working, and I don't know how many employees then are still at the department level. I haven't really studied it to know how that's working, but yeah, the hubs just didn't take off. Although there's, you know, they keep bringing it up. Bascom hasn't done it themselves, and I said, you know, you have to be the leader if you're going to... Bascom doesn't have a hub.
I have a lot of thoughts on that, I think, as well. I want to this is a little bit of an unrelated, but I want to backtrack to something you said earlier, that you mentioned that when you were meeting with over the years you've gone through these meetings of Big Ten directors, that it's changed now from you being the only woman to now it's almost all women.
Right.
What's it been like throughout your career, you've mentioned people like Serena Pondrum and strong mentor you, but do you have any thoughts about just how your career has gone and as a woman and
I think
these,
you know, it depends on how you think about it, because I think that when I was way back in nuclear physics, when I was hired by five professors, all men, they treated me like their daughter, you know, and they helped me. And I didn't resent that. And so as a result, and I think that's what's happened throughout my career a lot of times, I just haven't really thought about the fact that they're treating me different because I'm a woman. I think they've treated me, they've helped me come along, not because I'm a woman, but I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain. And I've always, you know, I like to be friends with them, and that's how they've treated me, is more of a friend and a, because I didn't have anyone who came in and said, well, you're going to do this now, or you're going to do this. You know, it was always, let's figure out how to do this, and let's, and I think possibly because of my attitude, I was able to progress more than if I would have said, well, I'm a woman and you need to pay me X, Y, and Z. When I look back, my salary was lower than all the men who came behind me. But, you know, at the same time, I kept thinking, but I've got a good salary. You know, so I didn't really resent. Although some of the people that I hired are now making a lot more than I made, and they go, I feel kind of guilty about this. I go, hey, don't.
It'll require another title reorganization perhaps to get this all in order.
I know. It has a lot to do with attitude. And.
Well, and it sounds like in a lot of ways you've kept a very consistent work ethic, and a lot of the attitude since nuclear physics has been the same. But I'm curious if you've thought about how you've changed in your career here.
Oh man, I've grown considerably. You know, I met my husband in nuclear physics, and he said, you were like big eyes and like, this is a whole new world here. And I'm sure it was. So over the, you know, you become much more confident, and certainly the first few times that you go and speak to a group, it's like, oh man, I don't know if I can do this. But then you have to think to yourself, well, I know more about this subject than they do. And so you have to keep telling yourself that when you get up and speak to large groups. And that seemed to help a lot, because I was never trained in how to be a public speaker. But I did have to speak to numerous groups, whether I went to Faculty Senate and spoke to them, and Academic Staff Assembly. And when we were doing training on... when we started doing training on on Lawson, I was, you know, speaking to groups and stuff. But anyhow...
You taught in the business school at one point, right?
about that's the Lawson, right. We talked to the students in the business school, and because we knew what we had done, with that academic staff review, and because we knew more about it than they did, you can't think about being nervous, if that's possible. But yeah, I think the fact that over the years I'm definitely a lot more confident, I've learned a lot, I certainly know the systems inside out, that, and you have to spend time working on each of the systems, and I'm not afraid to do much of anything now, I guess. Although I'd like to back away from some of these things now, I'd just as soon not have to work quite as much.
It's a reasonable ask. Throughout, maybe as you've been HR director in particular, I'm thinking, but this can be at other points as well, were there ideas you had, projects that you wanted to see implemented that really never got off the ground or turned into something else that you think back now and you're like, that would have been really great if we had actually...
You know, because when you were asking about Do It, you know, when we worked on IADS with Do It, that was our idea all the way through. We did that all the way through. And we did our own, that academic staff review. That was something that we came up with, because we said, we need a better way of determining what a salary should be. And so I think we didn't have to get a lot of permission. You know, we said, we're working on this. What do you think? And they go, oh, yeah, that sounds reasonable. You know, so... Yeah, I can't think of anything that I really wanted to do that no one would listen to me. It got to the point, though, where there was so much going on, I didn't have time to come up with new ideas
yeah.
because we had so much else that we had to try to balance. So, yeah, I think I can think of other things that we did a lot of big projects when you stop and think about it. And we had a lot of good help, good staff who did whatever
mm-hmm.
they needed to.
Changing gears slightly, what was the move like to 21 North Park when this building opened up?
We felt isolated because it was before Smith Hall was open.
Mm.
So it was like, man, we're just way out here in no man's land, you know.
Yeah.
Not that the Peterson building was wonderful, because we were down in the basement and there was mold and, oh, it was terrible place. And the other person I never mentioned was Dick Laufenberg, who was the most devoted payroll director I've ever seen. He kept that payroll running on a shoestring, you know, for years. And he had to deal with all those other campuses and
mm-hmm.
can't say enough about how good he was. And so when I became his supervisor, it was kind of like, oh, wow, you know. But we worked together really, really well. And then that's when I think I had some little grungy office down there in the Peterson building back in the cubby somewhere, because I didn't have space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go down there and make sure everything was going okay. And so it was nice to move into a new building. It was not designed the way it should have been,
mm-hmm.
Because this side of the hall has all cubbies, that side of the hall has all offices. You go upstairs or down to the financial area, and they got huge spaces. I mean, it was not consistently designed, and as a result, now employees are going, well, I want a window, well, I want an office. And you shouldn't have that. You should have,
mm-hmm.
they really should rip it all out and start over with the interior here. But I wasn't involved in the design. It was designed primarily by business services. But then when that director, because then I took over from business services, the payroll and the benefits, so
mm-hmm.
it was probably not a real fun time either, because that was a little hard for... it was decided by the vice chancellor that I should assume the responsibility and take it away from him, and I'm going, well, okay. but it worked out. We're still friends. So
that's good. And it's as like Smith has been built, and as it started,
it's definitely helped. I mean, at least we've got food,
right? Very important.
And a little bit of food over here on Park Street. Because before that, you know, you had to bring your lunch or you had to
mm-hmm.
walk a long ways in order
mm-hmm.
to find some food, and that's always important for
yeah.
employees. But no, now we don't feel, although they took away our bus service, I think that's unfortunate that
yeah.
we don't have a bus down here. And it would be nice to have a bus that would connect to the rest of the campus,
mm-hmm.
so we
mm-hmm.
walk a lot.
Yeah. And so... And I don't know how much of the new space had to contribute to this, but so in 2009 you decided to retire.
Yes, you know, I looked at my retirement, I looked at how old I was, can I get Social Security, you know,
mm.
so it all kind of fell in place. And then I thought they needed a new director. You know, I was a little tired too. And so they hired a new director, and then because they didn't have anyone available to take over the whole managing of the payroll and the benefits area, they said, oh, well, Carla, you want to come back and do that for a little while? Well, that turned out to be quite a while. But then finally hired Diane Boskowski, who is here now, and then the security had not been picked up by anyone, and security in HRS is quite complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking about, I have to start working with someone to... But now, going with a new system,
Right.
Do they really want to learn the old system? And, you know, so it's kind of those decisions now. What do we want to do with security? And whether, because I've told them, you know, on the new system, if you need me to make some suggestions on how security mm-hmm. should work, because it definitely was not done correctly with PeopleSoft, you should let mm-hmm. me know. I'll try to help you a little bit.
How long was it between your initial retirement in 2009 and when you actually started, you came back to start doing payroll and these other
supervisors? Back then, you only had to be off the payroll for 1 month.
I
was just off 1 month, and then I came back. You know, I probably should have taken a little more time off, but, you know, things were just hopping here, too, and it was like, nobody's here to do. And the new director, I think he was hired by then, but, you know, he was very unfamiliar with mm-hmm. the office, and so he needed some support, too. But mm-hmm. And now the person who's director is someone I hired, so...
All comes around.
It all comes around, yes.
Do you ever wish you had stayed longer or tried to go?
No. No. Supervision is not easy.
Mm.
Yeah. No, I think supervision is probably the most difficult part of any manager job. It's one thing to, and I'm talking more about individual supervision, not mm-hmm. necessarily the managing of the office, but, you know, having to sit down and do the mm-hmm. performance reviews and taking care of the problems. The problems are probably the worst.
Imagine.
Especially if they come in on time and they don't do this and they don't do that. And
I think I know the answer to this, but I'm curious. And you had mentioned, you know, you've gotten to know, when you were director in particular, you know, directors at other universities. Did you ever think about looking somewhere else and not staying at UW-Madison?
I did interview for a job at, I can't remember the name of it. Well, I was recommended by a dean for a position. Oh, man, it's been so long ago. They've moved out of state now. They moved to Minneapolis, and they were not an insurance company. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a very high-paying HR job. And I thought about it, but then I thought, you know, I'm pretty much tied to this area. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't see another Big Ten school that would have pulled my family out of here. And my husband has a good job that he wouldn't want to leave. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, we were pretty much here. And the family was here, although not anymore. Everyone's passed away. And now my kids are Chicago and Montana.
Yeah.
So, but we're still pretty much tied to this area, just because we grew up here and know it. So I never really considered another job other than that one up north somewhere. I put it out of my mind.
That brings up another, that one of the in the midst of all the talk about your accomplishments in your career, you're raising two kids all during this time.
Well, believe it or not, my first one was born and I was back to work in 6 weeks. Second one was born and I was back to work in 2 weeks. I was very fortunate to have a wonderful babysitter who was in her 70s, took both boys, and we were close to the schools and the preschool, and she would take them to, you know, to preschool and make sure they got to school. And yeah, she was wonderful. You can't find that today. And, yeah, I walked up and down Bascom when I was 9 months pregnant, twice. Stayed in good shape.
I believe it.
My boys were 9'2" and 8'10", so they were big, good-sized boys.
Did they spend a lot of time on campus growing up?
They did. My husband would, back then the traffic wasn't near as heavy, so he would come in rather frequently and pick me up with the boys, and so they got to know the staff, and yeah, we used to spend time walking up and down State Street a lot more than we do now, because
mm-hmm.
now it's just not worth driving in at night.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, the boys did, and my oldest son went to school here, went to computer engineering, And I don't know if I told you, he's a day trader in Chicago.
Oh.
Once he graduated, he didn't really find a job and didn't know what to do. And someone saw him playing video games and said, you know, you ought to try out for a day trader. And so he got on his motorcycle, went downtown Chicago, took the test, and became a day trader.
Mm-hmm.
And he, the first a couple of months, you know, you don't make money being a day trader when you're just learning. And
mm-hmm.
so he was sleeping on my niece's couch, and we were trying to support him while he lost about $40,000 working for this company. And then he started making money, and now he makes way more money than you can imagine. So, he made the right career move.
I learned a thing or two from you over the years, I would think.
Well, the boys are very, they work hard, you know. I don't see them sloughing off ever. You know, they're always going to work. They're always they're sticking to it. That's what's important.
Well, we've made our way through
okay.
a lot of your career, but are there any
I kind of
thoughts that you
yeah.
that we haven't gotten to yet, or things that
yeah,
you
I think we kind of touched on most everything. I know there were a lot of things that were going on, but not worth getting into that some of those details. You know, I had expectations of the staff.
Ah.
First priority is customer service. And then I had expectation of the directors, you know. So we did that sort of thing that I think was helpful. It was very much, you know, I had things like treat each other with respect and
mm-hmm.
set a positive example and be open to suggestions and, you know,
mm-hmm.
more. I just kind of grew up that way, I guess.
Is that, I guess, do you notice a difference, I guess, in having to manage people working in an HRS office versus, you know, being in divisions and departments? Is
I don't think so.
The kind
you
of
know?
Expectations you have?
Yeah,
or,
yeah I would think
mm-hmm.
it is, what
yeah.
I had here would be true for any department, any division. Because, if you know, I have the positive attitude and
mm-hmm.
being flexible and demonstrate a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is very, very true for wherever you work. You want copies of these?
I do. I could use them for sure. Well, if there's no other...
I can't think of anything else that... Yeah, because when Biddy came, I was pretty much on my way out, so I didn't know Biddy
mm-hmm.
very well. I knew her, but not. I mean, John Wiley was my last real chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
And, but no, I think we pretty much covered the gamut here.
This has been excellent. And if, you know, if afterwards any thoughts come to mind, I can always come back down here.
Absolutely.
I'm happy to get the recording going. We can talk on the phone, but... I'm going to stop it here. I'm just but on the record to say thank you so much. This
You're
has
welcome.
Been amazing. I feel very privileged to get to hear about your career. It's
thank you.
Incredibly impressive.
It was interesting
appreciate
going
your time.
Back and trying to remember because sometimes I can't remember what happened yesterday.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. Well, thank you again, Carl.
You're welcome.
I'm gonna